I'd like to call to order tonight's meeting of the Committee on Public Safety Policy and Finance, Monday, April 4th, 2005. Clerk, the roll.
Chairman Smith?
Here.
Representative Eastland?
Here.
Cornish?
Here.
Ellison?
Here.
Hillsum?
Here.
Johnson? Meslow?
Here.
Murphy?
Here.
Nelson?
Here.
Newman?
Here.
Amar?
Here.
Soderstrom?
Here.
All right, first of all, let's see, we've got minutes for consideration and approval. March 30, 2005 minutes, and March 31, 2005 as well. They're in the packet. Representative Cornish moves approval of both sets of those minutes. Any discussion or questions? If not, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails, and those minutes are adopted. All right, members, we have a few bills tonight. The first one is House File 2085, Smith, HIV testing and sex offender victim notification procedures. And I believe that one, there will be a motion to move approval and refer to the Committee on Health Policy. I think we're taking that one first because it requires a vote beyond. Chairman, I would move House File 2085 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Policy.
Okay, that's moved by the Representative Smith. Go ahead and present the bill, sir.
Very good. I have a testifier with us this evening. This bill clarifies notification procedures in criminal assault conduct. Requests HIV testing of the perpetrator. Requires a court order directing the offender to undergo HIV testing. This is an agency bill. The Department of Corrections. I would ask the witness here to walk through the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Nan Schrader. I'm the Director of Health Services with the Minnesota Department of Corrections. This is truly a technical bill. Current statute requires the department's medical director to notify a victim when there's been a court order for an HIV testing of an offender. The department's medical director does not have a therapeutic relationship with the victim, and given that there are some pre- and post-test counseling that needs to happen with HIV test results, we thought it more appropriate for the victim's health care provider to provide that information. So the department's medical director will in turn notify the victim's health care provider, and then the health care provider will inform the victim of the results. Pretty technical in nature.
Any questions or comments on the bill? I have one question. I was just going to ask. This basically requires testing for the victim. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, no. It's for the offender. When a victim who has been sexually assaulted by an offender wants to know whether or not the offender is HIV positive, we will usually get a court order to have that test done. We would like to get those results then, instead of having our medical director give the results directly to the victim.
Okay.
We would like that those results to go through that victim's own.
Okay, any other questions or comments on the bill? Anybody in the audience care to comment on the bill? Okay, Chairman, remove the motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Remove the motion that House File 2085 be recommended to pass the re-referred health policy.
Okay, all those in favor of that motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, the motion passes. Thank you.
All right, the next file is House File 1031, Representative Zellers. Abortion definition modified relating to criminal sexual conduct law, step parents authorized, etc. Representative Zellers. Chair will move the bill. It's before the committee, so go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. It's a very technical bill in nature. We're updating primarily the technology part of stocking. As a new dad, I have one of those 5 megahertz baby monitors in your home. You can put it in one room, you can go outside and play with the dog, break your lawn, you can hear the baby inside. Well, some more nefarious characters in our society have taken and used that for stocking purposes. This law is saying we update the use of technology so that when they're doing that, that will be included. It's a technical update. I also have with me, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee, Karen Long from the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault. Let her bring in comments, then we'll scan for questions.
Thank you very much, Representative Zellers. Ms. Long, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I won't burden you with a line-by-line discussion, but just to tell you that the group of modifications that we're offering here were reached after myself, I'm the staff attorney at the coalition, I have a prosecution background. Myself and our staff have met with a group of prosecutors and law enforcement who have brought to us various issues that they wanted us to address. So representatives of various county attorney's offices as well as law enforcement agencies have looked at this language and have reached these decisions. And I think the one thing that I would want to just comment is that the amendment waiving the fee, it's not an amendment, but the change waiving the fee for victims of sexual assault who want a harassment restraining order is actually required by the Violence Against Women Act, which is the large federal funding act from which we receive millions of dollars as a state, and we are actually required by that act not to charge a fee for those things, so it brings us into compliance with a large federal funding act. So I'll just leave it at that.
Any questions? Either the bill author or the witness.
Chair?
Madam Messler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just looking at the changes on page 1, the definition of coercion. I'm wondering if either Representative Zellers or Ms. Long can explain what that's about.
Ms. Long.
Mr. Chair and Representative Neslow, that was brought to us, that request was brought to us by a couple of different prosecutors who are indicating that when they, of course, the jury instructions that they use in a jury trial are based upon the statutory language, of course, and when they have used the jury instructions as they exist now, they have found it to be rather cumbersome to explain the use of coercion or force. The term force and coercion always appear together in various statutes, criminal sexual conduct statutes. And they were just finding the terminology to be cumbersome and a little bit unrelated to the very common cases that they see. Very commonly, a person will use superior size or strength to impose criminal sexual conduct on a victim, rather than some of the other language that it appears now in the statute. The other reason that this was useful is that it really clearly differentiates force from coercion. Right now, if you look at the language, the word force is actually used in the definition of coercion, so that's a little bit circular, and it can be difficult for prosecutors to differentiate between the two. So as I say, they brought that to us, asking us to use this language that they feel it more accurately reflects what they see in their cases.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Ellison.
I'm sorry, ma'am, I didn't get your name.
Karen Long.
Ms. Long, thank you. As I'm looking over the changes in Subdivision 14, the one thing that does concern me a little bit is that it's not clear to me, and maybe you could help point it out, where there's at least some requirement that the actor performed an overt act in order to coerce. I'm concerned that somebody could be presumed to have coerced someone simply because they're bigger than the person who is accusing them of coercion. Is there some other act in here that the actor must perform in order to complete coercion? I get, you understand what I'm saying? I mean, I could well be wrong, and I'm just hoping you can correct me, because I'm not seeing here where and in the last sentences, which is not being changed, but proof of coercion does not require proof of a specific act or threat. But it appears that, you know, superior size of strength could be, I don't know, could be the basis of a coercive act. Am I wrong about that?
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Ellison, first of all, I would say that the definition in Subdivision 14 is in the initial section. It's in 609.341 at the beginning, where there's all the definition. In each of the actual statutes for criminal sexual conduct in the first degree, second degree, there is, of course, an act required to commit the offense. This is simply the definition of when they're using either force or coercion, what that means. So, of course, they are required to submit either penetration or contact against the person's will in the rest of the statute. So this isn't the only criminal conduct.
Mr. Chair, and I understand that, Ms. Long, and I appreciate you pointing that out to me and the rest of the committee members. But, you know, as you probably are well aware, you know, consent is a defense to some acts of criminal sexual conduct.
Yes.
Certainly not all, but some it is. And in those cases where the defense is consent, it appears that the state could meet its burden of proving coercion simply by pointing out that the act is larger than the other person. Is that right?
Mr. Chair and Representative Ellison, I would note that our proposed language here actually adds the phrase against the complainant's will, which was not previously in the language. And it does indicate that it's causing the complainant to submit, which used to be there, against the complainant's will, which didn't used to be there. So arguably, it clarifies that it must be that they're causing somebody to submit to something against their will, which actually wasn't even there before. So I think that, as I said, there is a physical act that's required beyond what's indicated right in this little subdivision. And I can understand the concern that you're getting at, but I think that the statutes all read together, in some way, this requires, it just clarifies that an actual act of physical imposement has to be completed in order to violate the statute.
Thank you.
Further questions?
Representative Newman. Thank you, Mr. Chair. When I look at line 27, which is the area that Representative Ellison was just talking about, it talks about the use by the actor of the confinement does not have the word use of superior size of strength. I'm just wondering if that is what Representative Ellison is trying to mean. It seems to me that the use of superior size of strength would have to be part of this. It's like a statute. I don't think that he says that. And I'm just wondering if Representative Zeller, if we couldn't make that. The statute clearly indicates that the act of using superior size of strength against the complainant causes it.
Representative Zeller, Ms. Long, do you want to respond to that?
Sure. I saw Representative Meswell with statutes, so I don't know if you wanted to add into the discussion or add in or take away.
Representative Meswell, do you want to make a comment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I might, I have what I believe is a friendly amendment to offer, because I was listening to Representative Ellison and also having the very same thought that Representative Newman did in terms of addressing this. My suggestion would be, and I think it merely clarifies, I don't think it changes the intent of what we've got, but my suggestion would be on line 23, following the first or, to insert the use of prior to superior size or strength. I think that's already what the statute says, but I think it is susceptible to different interpretations. If we put that language in, then there's no confusion anymore, and I would respectfully offer that as a friendly amendment if the author's interested.
Okay, we have an amendment. Amendment being after the word to the first or on page 23, insert the use of.
Chairman Eastland, Representative Meslow, yeah, it's exactly what Ms. Long and I were looking at here. We both written down too, and I wish Representative Allison was here, but I think that's in the spirit and in honors in talking about some of these things in the past. When prosecutors jump back and forth from one section to another, sometimes that's lost. This may just be maybe a little over coverage, but by my estimations, I'd rather have that. That's why we're doing this, is to be safer rather than sorry. But I'd accept that as a friendly amendment, Chair Eastland.
Okay. I guess we don't have to vote on it then, do we? We'll just incorporate that into the bill.
Okay.
Any other questions or concerns on the bill? Anybody in the audience wish to speak to for or against the bill? Okay, then we'll... what was that, another amendment? Okay, Representative Mulry asked that an A1 amendment be prepared for the bill, but after reviewing his committee work, Representative Mulry has asked that the amendment not be offered. So there was an amendment that was going to be offered tonight, but it's not. So if there's no other questions or no other comments on the bill, we'll lay the bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Chair Eastland, members of the committee. Thank you.
So we're going to have to leave Smithville. So what are we going to do here, guys?
Smith.
He's presenting the map.
Where are you? Is it up tonight?
It's tomorrow.
Tomorrow.
If you want to present it?
That's all right. We'll start looking at it.
So we need Representative Johnson or...
He's presenting the math, though.
Representative Ellison?
He had to run and vote in another committee.
Okay. Representative Mulry is not here.
See if we can get Mulry.
Anybody got any pizza?
Representative, can we discuss his bill for tomorrow and then we could just act tomorrow?
We could do that. Representative Newman is going to have a bill heard tomorrow. It's House File, what is it? 2005. Okay, for the benefit of the committee, we can maybe just present the bill and informationally and discuss it, and then we can move on tomorrow.
Isn't all that much.
What's that?
After we're done with that, we can take the Mulry book because it's not all
that much. Smith is back, so we'll go back to Plan A.
Sorry.
So the next bill on the agenda is House File 1752. Please. Go ahead, move your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to move House File 1752 and then ask that it be laid over for possible inclusion.
Okay, the bill is before us. Go ahead and tell us a little bit about it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll be brief. This is not an agency bill. I have no testifiers except myself. This idea came to me, the bill came to me from a resident in Mound who frankly was tired of seeing children left unattended in a running automobile. I asked Mr. Diebel on our staff, our legislative analyst, to take a look at laws, ordinances, see what we had on the books already. And very briefly, I'll just report to you that he informs me that we have a statute, section 169.36, that reads, and I'll read it because it's brief, no person driving or in charge of a motor vehicle shall permit it to stand unattended without effectively setting the brake thereon and turning the front wheels to the curb or side of the highway, unquote. That does not fit the fact situation in and of itself. It doesn't require the driver to disengage the ignition or to remove the keys. Statute 169.89 has this to say. If the violation is committed in a manner or under circumstances so as to endanger or be likely to endanger any person or property, it is a misdemeanor. Our staff attorney reports he could not find any case law where a prosecutor had applied 169.36. Mr. Chairman and members, there are various city ordinances that skirt the issue and address it indirectly. For example, Mound has a city ordinance, and this is we looked at Mound because this is where this incident started, this process, and it has an ordinance relative to removing keys. No person shall leave a motor vehicle except a truck, which is engaged in loading or unloading, unattended on any street, used car lot, unattended parking lot without first stopping the engine, locking the ignition, and removing all ignition keys from the vehicle. Some additional language. Minneapolis has a similar ordinance. Our staff attorney also found that a couple of prosecutors throughout the state have tried to bring charges under the fact situation that the resident saw, and that was an unattended parked car, engine running with children inside. Frankly, the county attorney in Stearns sought prosecution. The judge dismissed charges for lack of probable cause. There was a district court in another one in Stearns County. Here the district court concluded that the defendant's actions were, quote, not likely, unquote, to result in substantial harm to children. So the conclusion or suggestion I got from staff was simply that the two recent cases hold in court, child endangerment law will only apply in cases where children are left in the car and suffer some substantial harm, or where it's more likely than not they will receive some substantial harm. Basically, we have city ordinances that around the state, take that back. We found one in Mound and one in Minneapolis. It seemed to address this issue. We have a law that we've seen two district courts attempt to address the issue in court to no avail. And frankly, Mr. Chairman, I simply believe that it is never safe to leave a child in an unattended running car. And this statute, if included, becomes a statute, would address this fact situation statewide. That has piecemeal been addressed in various municipalities.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Smith, I think that you have a really good idea here, but I have a couple of questions about the broader child neglect and endangerment picture. It's clear that you had or you've heard some cases where people have attempted to prosecute this. Just defining child neglect or endangerment in the statute doesn't necessarily get the county to do anything about it. One of my frustrations is that child protection is very much underfunded, and the large complaints that you get range, you know, from children being tied up to abuse, and ultimately they can only deal with the cases that have, you know, the immediate harm happening right away. So my question to you is this a different way of dealing with a situation of child neglect potentially? Then I think maybe we should look at doing some other things as well with this, or do you just see this as, you know, going to be a part of the other long list that counties are going to need to take into account as they prosecute all other child neglect cases?
Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hillstrom, I see this as adding clearly defined language into our neglect statute that has been addressed in at least two cities that we found, to make it clear and simple that the act of leaving the child unattended and running car is forbidden.
Meslow, Representative Meslow, you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Smith, just a brief comment. I think that it seems to me, and maybe you can elaborate on this, maybe you may be familiar with it, Representative Smith, but we had a case, I believe it was in Minneapolis, in the last year where something just like this happened, and in fact the car was then carjacked, and we had those kinds of issues, and it seems to me those are the types of things that your bill is seeking to prevent. Have I got that about right?
Representative Mesla, I think so. You can run any set of hypotheticals along. A car could put itself into a vertical forward with a child inside, and it could cause severe harm. There have been a number of carjackings, one very recent, I think the one you're referring to a couple weeks ago. And that situation, I believe, would fall under this language as well. And the language is designed to allow anyone seeing the situation to alert the police and or the police stepping in and responding before there's a carjacking, before there's an accident.
So it's not only punitive but preventive as well.
Yes, I hope so.
Thank you.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, does the car have to be running for this law to apply? Or is number one or there? Or I? If the child is left in the car and the car isn't running, but the child is harmed.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, there is an or on line 13, but the language taken together suggests that leaving the child or children left unattended in a running car would be the qualifying conditions.
So this doesn't apply to leaving the child unattended, but the car is not running on a hot day.
Representative Smith.
Representative Murphy, that's my intent, and I think the language should be read that way. At least that's the way it's intended.
For just the running car.
Correct.
Any other questions,
Let me elaborate a little further on that. Perhaps the intent was to, if a child was left unattended in a running car, but I can see on lines 12 and 13 the conditions of risk would be present if the child was left in a car that was unattended, not running, with the windows rolled up in the summertime. Then you've got a situation where the child is at risk. So in that case, the car would not have to be running, in my opinion.
That gets my point then, Mr. Chair. Then I would think that you would want an earlier effective date then, because July gets very, very hot. I would think we would want an earlier effective date so that the child is not dead because of the heat.
Effective upon enactment.
Mr.
Chair, I would offer that. Representative Murphy, if you'd care to offer that amendment.
You accept that as friendly?
Accept that.
Okay. So it'll be on line 18. It would be the section is effective upon enactment.
Further, I'd ask you to lay that over for possible inclusion.
Representative Meslow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry to hold this up, but I, particularly as Representative Murphy, I think very appropriately brought forward the point that those health issues could be endangered if it's too hot. It would be my interpretation of this bill that it would also apply if it were extremely cold and a child were left unattended in a vehicle that was not running, so that in any of those types of circumstances that it would apply if, in fact, there was a danger or potential danger to the child's health. Representative Smith, am I interpreting that correctly?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Smith. Now that we're discussing this further, I would imagine a substantial cold or extreme cold would have the same effect under this language as with extreme heat.
Mr. Chairman.
The idea is to get folks to quit leaving their kids at home.
Representative Nelson.
I guess the question I have here, having had multiple kids at any young ages, how long do they got to be unattended? I mean, if you're loading 2-3 kids into a car, be it summer, winter, whenever, you put one in, you get to go back to the house to get the car seat for the second one. Are they unattended then? And could that unintentionally bring a parent into, get bit by this law? Loading back and forth. I guess that's just a question to raise.
Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman, my response would be, that's why we have men and women with robes and sitting in courthouses to determine under any given fact situation what would constitute a court, or rather present a risk to the child's health and safety. Clearly, under speculation or whatever, 5 minutes in a closed car in 95-degree temperature would create, even 1 minute, 2 minutes might create a risk, whereas the same situation when it's 50 degrees and the windows are cracked would take beyond that. And again, it depends on other conditions present that would create the risk. So I think I would not want to say, well, 5 minutes is the cutoff, or 10. I think it's for each fact situation that would come up after this law is in effect.
Okay, Representative Smith has renewed his motion that House File 1752 as amended be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Next on the agenda is House File 1251. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I would also move this bill and ask that it be laid over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. And I have with us Mr. Don Bruce, the Assistant Dakota County Attorney. And this bill modifies requirements for adoption consents and adoption placements. And I'm going to ask Mr. Bruce to describe the bill, and we'll try to answer your question.
Okay, the bill is before us. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Bruce. Would you please state your name and then proceed with your comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Don Bruce. I'm an Assistant Dakota County Attorney, and I'm here today representing the Minnesota County Attorneys Association, who are asking that this bill be passed on. This bill contains essentially two provisions. First one is dealing with consents to adopt provisions. There has been a provision to consent to adopt in Minnesota Statutes Chapter 259.24 for some time. That provides that there is a 10-day window for a parent to revoke their consent. The idea being that a person, a mother who has just given birth to a child may be under significant stress and gives a consent and allows that window for them to withdraw that consent. That language was later moved into Chapter 260C as another permanency option for children who are going through the child protection system. And that 10-day window language went along with it. And our position is that that 10-day window under these circumstances should be closed. It's a completely different circumstance. Parents are in the child protection system. By the time we're looking at permanency, they've been working with child protection or not working with them, as more typically the case, and a petition to terminate parental rights has been filed with the court. What often happens, and the reason we feel that this window should be closed, is that we'll come up to the day of trial. The mother, typically the mother at that point, will opt to consent to the adoption, so the matter gets settled that day. Then within 10 days, she revokes that consent. The matter gets delayed. It has to go back onto the trial calendar at a later date, and it causes delays in the permanency for the child. So we're asking that in these circumstances, that ability to delay this proceeding in that way would be taken away. The consent option would still be there, and the bill has language in it to provide clearly that the mother, and again, it's usually the mother, would have clear notice that under these circumstances that consent is not revocable. But after we've seen what has happened with it, we see that our position is it should not be revocable under these circumstances. The bill, that part of the bill also provides that the counties and the commissioner can move on to another placement short of a year, short of the 12 months that the law now requires, if the home that the mother has consented to place the child in is clearly not working out. So we think, again, we're moving towards permanency for that child more quickly. The second part of the bill is a requirement for a background check on potential placements for the child. Currently, if we place a child in a foster home, there is a background check that is always required. And what we want to look for, we do not require a background check if the placement is with a relative or the non-custodial parent. And we feel that it's very important to require a background check in those situations also. We certainly don't want to be in a position where we place a child, or the court has placed a child, or social services, or a county attorney has recommended that a child be placed in a home of a relative, and then we later find out that that relative has a prior conviction for sex conduct or physical assault of a child, or child endangerment or something like that. So it's very important that we have that piece of information when we are looking at a placement for a child, even when it's a relative or a non-custodial parent. This bill sets up a requirement, and it also sets up a process for us to do that. For example, currently, under the current law, in our office we have a terminal where we can access this information, but we are forbidden to use that terminal for these purposes. This bill would allow them for us to use that terminal in our office to do these checks very quickly. For multi-state checks, there is virtually no process right now to obtain this information if the relative or the non-custodial parent that we're looking at is in another state. The only way we can get this information now is to go through the interstate contact process, which can be very slow and cumbersome and take literally months to get that information. Meanwhile, the child is not with a relative or custodial, a non-custodial parent when they should be. So we're looking for a means to get at that information and to use it. There have been some concerns raised along the way about the original language in this bill, about the broad nature of it. We have met with the groups that have been concerned about that, that represent some the African American community, the Native American community, and we believe that our concessions and the language that's been put into the amendment has taken care of those concerns. There is a definition for reasonable cause that we would have to go ahead with these background searches, and the information that we obtain and use would be provided to the subject of that data. So we think we've alleviated many of their concerns, and so we're hoping that the bill can go forward in its present form. With that, I can certainly answer, hope to answer that
question. Representative, did you want to move the DE2 amendment? Is that?
Yes.
So, okay, so we have the DE2 amendment has been moved. Are there any is before us here? No. I guess we got to put it on first, don't we? All those in favor of the DE2 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. The amendment is on the bill. Any comments or questions on the amendment or the bill as amended? Any other comments, Representative Smith? Anybody in the audience wish to comment on the bill? We have somebody that'd like to make a comment. So, welcome to the committee. Would you please identify yourself for the record and then proceed with your comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Paula McAbee, and I'm the project director for Our Children, Our Future. It's a nonprofit group dedicated to eliminating the disparities that African American and American Indian children experience in systems of child welfare. And we haven't seen the amendment. I'm assuming it's the same as what was put together in the Senate. And those amendments do answer a lot of the questions that we brought forth. Some of the changes, for example, before adoption becomes irrevocable, the parents have to have notice that the adoption is going to be irrevocable, that they're not going to have the opportunity to change their mind. There's some narrowing of the scope of the criminal investigations. The way the bill was originally written, if a mom temporarily lost custody, she'd have to go through a complete background check before getting her kids back, which could go into any aspects of a fishing expedition into her life. There's also some change so that even if a dad hadn't been involved in that problem at all, that the state could apply a best interest test to use to decide whether or not the dad or the state ought to have the children. What I heard, I think that this has been a challenging process because in many ways the communities of color that I'm working with don't like the bill at all, the second part, because they're afraid that it may have a chilling effect on relatives who want to step forward and take care of kids when a family's in trouble. I felt that we had made some very significant compromises. I just learned today that there may be tribal representatives who had not been at the table who are still uncomfortable with the second half of the bill having to do with criminal history. I didn't realize that there were still tribal representatives that hadn't been consulted. I just brought that to the attention of the county attorneys today, and they haven't had any chance to see if those concerns could be met. I believe that amendment is a big step forward from the initial bill. but I want to make sure that people understand that there is one community out there, the tribal leaders, who feel that there's still significant problems with the criminal history aspects of the bill.
Yeah, thank you for your testimony. Any questions of this testifier? Thank you, Ms. McAbee. Anybody else in the audience that would wish to testify for or against the bill? Okay, then we will lay the bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Next on the agenda is House File 1602, Representative Smith.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to move House File 1602 and request that after discussion be laid over before and possibly introduced.
I believe there's an amendment. Did you want to move that amendment to DE3? Where did I find it? DE2? There's a DE2.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to
there's a DE3-1.
Is
that the one we want to move?
Yes.
DE3-1? Okay, we have DE3-1 is moved to get the bill in the shape the author intends. All in favor of DE3-1 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, the amendment is adopted. The bill is before us. Should go ahead and tell us about the bill.
Mr. Chairman, I will briefly open our presentation and then I'll have Pete Cahill from the Hennepin County Attorney's Office, who is no longer here
this evening, but we have Frigate, who is more than welcome to stand in for him, I assure you.
Some weeks ago, this committee started discussing the
text of the so-called Blakely decision, Blakely versus Washington.
And this bill has been worked
out, hopefully,
to some agreement here to answer those
questions raised by the Blakely court. Recall, Mr. Chairman.
Well, maybe we can just hold up a second. We're having two people do not have the amendment. Who does not have the amendment in front of them here?
I don't think you can do that.
Okay, so. Okay, everybody else has the amendment or the summary in front of them?
I don't think he said it either.
Mr. Chair. Is there also a House research on the DE3-1? Because we have the DE2.
We have the
DE1 and the.
I don't believe we have a research on the DE3. DE3-1 amendment? Yeah, okay. Okay, maybe we'll have our counsel here tell us a little bit about the differences. I think we have two of them in our, but I don't think we have the DE3-1. So why don't you explain what the differences are?
There is a DE3-1 bill summary. Mr. Chair and representatives, the differences between the DE3-1 and the DE2 are basically technical changes. I think when we go through them, they'll be apparent. Probably the biggest change is in Section 1. And where it says that the guidelines in Section 1 may provide for an increase or decrease of up to... Excuse me. After 85 to 200%, that was moved to Section 14. And that's probably the biggest change. Otherwise, they're pretty much the same.
Okay, does everybody have enough information in front of here to proceed? Okay, why don't you go ahead and proceed with the testimony and bill.
Mr. Chairman,
I'm going to open the discussion and just remind the committee that a few weeks ago we had a presentation and some discussion at the time as to the effects of the Blakely versus Washington decision. And as you probably recall, that court in Blakely said that it was unconstitutional under a person's right to a jury trial to allow a court to make findings of fact that would increase the sentence for the foreign offense beyond the guidelines presumptive sentence. Minnesota appellate courts took up the case and had their own holding that was limited, and basically it's called into question our sentencing guidelines and our procedures for allowing dispositional upward departures. Now, I'm going to ask now to a little more thoroughly discuss this bill as amended.
Can you identify yourself for the record and proceed with your comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Hillary Caligiuri. I'm a prosecutor with the Hennepin County Attorney's Office. As Representative Smith stated, this arises out of the Blakely v. Washington decision that came out during the summer of last year. That decision was predicated on the earlier Apprendi decision, where the U.S. Supreme Court said that any fact that increases the penalty for a crime beyond the statutory max must be submitted to a jury and proved beyond a reasonable doubt. Blakely, last year, took that one step further, and instead of statutory max, they're now saying the maximum sentence that a judge may impose without additional findings. For Minnesota, with our guidelines, that means that under Blakely, a judge cannot depart from the fairly narrow sentencing ranges that are set forth in the sentencing guidelines without impaneling a sentencing jury and having the prosecutor prove those departure factors to a jury beyond a reasonable doubt. The impact of that is on resources of the court, of the public defenders, and of the county attorneys in impaneling those sentencing juries and having those additional hearings. The language before you in the DE3-1 is based on a Minnesota County Attorneys Association proposal that is intended to preserve the status quo in sentencing, keep sentences exactly the same length as they are now, while solving the fiscal and resource problems raised by the Blakely case. The main piece of the bill in Section 1 of the bill and the later directions to the Sentencing Guidelines Commission would expand the guidelines ranges. They would put the bottom of the range 15% below the current midpoint of the range. It would raise the top of the box to 100% above where the top is now. These expanded ranges would allow the court to exercise its discretion without impaneling a sentencing jury when sentencing within that range. We would, however, and this is important, and this is in the instructions to the Guidelines Commission, maintain a single number in those boxes as well. In addition to the range, we would maintain a historical reference point. So, for instance, a box that now has 48, the number 48 in it, and now shows a fairly small range around that 48, the 48 would stay there. The range would be broader. But the intent of retaining that historical reference point, that historical midpoint, would be to guide practitioners, the county attorneys, the public defenders, and the judges, toward maintaining sentencing practices as they exist today. Remind them that this is what has been found to be an appropriate sentence for the typical type of crime in that particular box. But it would free the courts from the constraints of those narrow guidelines that would not permit a court to depart upward from the narrow guidelines without a jury finding. We believe that this would maintain status quo in sentencing. It would keep sentences as they are now, and therefore it would have no adverse bed impact. If anything, in fact, it could have a bed impact, and we actually expect that it would have a slight positive impact bed-wise. We've done some research and found that statewide, 25% of all commit cases are sentenced at the bottom of the box, as we say, usually by agreement. It's a very typical negotiation to offer the bottom of the box, and if that practice were to continue, when those boxes are lowered 15%, as we expect that it would, there would be a very significant savings on the bottom end. In addition to that significant change, the language before you would also make some changes to MnSTAT 609.108, 0.109, and .1095. Those are statutes right now that are sentencing enhancements based on both prior convictions and on factual findings that previously have always been made by a judge. Now under Blakely, the courts have said that a jury would have to make those factual findings. So this would delete those factual findings and make those items simply based on findings of prior convictions. And I should note for the committee that other bills, particularly House File 1406, with the sex offender amendments, might make some of that language superfluous. This was drafted with status quo in mind, and so when the committee puts together its ultimate omnibus bill, you'll have to make some decisions about what's appropriate to include. Finally, the bill provides guidance procedurally on what needs to be done to comply with the Blakely decision. So far, the courts have not acted. The Rules Committees have not taken up the issue of Blakely compliant procedures, such as how a hearing would be conducted. And we've got 87 different things going on around the state, and practitioners would love to get some guidance on this. So finally, the final part of the bill does provide some guidance procedurally on how to comply with Blakely. Those are the main points, and I'd be happy to answer any questions the committee has.
Representative Ellison.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, has the Supreme Court looked at how they want to approach compliance with the Blakely decision? Generally, they promulgate rules. Are there going to be any changes to the Minnesota Rules of Criminal Procedure to accommodate this? Whoever.
Ms. Calgary.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Ellison. They so far have not taken it up. We would presume that, in fact, they've been waiting to see what the legislature is going to do, and two different members of the Minnesota Supreme Court have referred to this as a legislative issue. It could happen in the future, but it's not happening right now. And so that's why we feel that practitioners, both courts and attorneys, would be assisted by getting some guidance today.
So,
Representative Ellison?
Just to get it clear, in a case where a prosecutor thinks they might seek an upward departure, they got to file a notice, right? And then 15 days before the trial, the defense can file a motion for a Blakely hearing. Is that it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Olson, this language does not give specific deadlines. Okay. It's not as specific. It does require reasonable notice. So it's a little bit unlike some of the other proposals that have been out there in that way, but it would be up to the court to determine whether something is reasonable. As you know, upward departure issues may come up at different times. Sometimes they're going to come up real early. Sometimes they're going to come up during the trial itself, and that's why the language requires reasonable notice.
Senator Ellison.
Now, you know, that's one of the things about Blakely that does kind of present sort of a quandary I haven't figured out is if the basis for an upward departure comes up in the trial, what do we do? Do we have to retry the case? Do we have to have a mistrial declared and start all over? Because it is the jury that has to decide that issue. Do you just automatically go to a bifurcated trial? I mean, because when I was looking at the other amendment, there were these time slides, 60 days and all that. But under the reasonable standard, what do we do if the basis for an aggravated upward departure comes up in the course of trial?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ellison, you present exactly the facts that we're hoping to accommodate by not putting in the timelines that you've seen in a different draft. When we require reasonable notice, if something were to come up during the course of trial, my expectation would be that if it is a factor that is admissible in trial and would not prejudice the defendant by including it in the trial, we would go on to include that in the same deliberations and not bifurcate the trial. If it's something that would be prejudicial to the defendant, then these rules do provide that the trial should be bifurcated in that instance.
Does this amendment provide for informing the jury? I mean, is the jury going to be informed whether this is going to be a Blakely issue in the case or not? Or
No.
Ms. Gelder?
Representative, Mr. Chair, Representative Ellison, no, it doesn't provide for a jury instruction, and we would expect that the district judges would draft, in fact, they have been working on jury instructions, so we didn't get as specific here as jury instructions, but I would expect during the deliberations, they will certainly be, they will be informed of that. During the trial itself, no. During the argument, they would be, if it's being argued in one shot. You'll also notice that in the delete all amendment, there is an opportunity it's on page 4, lines 4 and 5. There's an opportunity to allow bifurcated arguments and jury deliberations. But this actually is something that was raised by on Heffelfinger, that when you have a unitary trial, which is certainly much better resource-wise, there may be times when it would not be fair to argue that aggravating factor during the final argument, during the one final argument on the elements. And so this would allow that to take place separately so that you would not impanel a different jury or anything like that. You would simply bifurcate only that final argument and the deliberations. So the jury would go out once. They would determine guilt or innocence. They would then come back to another short argument simply on the aggravating factor and decide that issue.
Thank you. Any other questions of the author of the witness? Anybody in the audience that would like to speak for or against the bill? Ms. Toombs would like to make a comment here, I think so. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record, and you can proceed with your comments.
My name is Barb Timms. I'm director of the Mental Health Sentencing Guidelines Commission. The chair. We have looked at the amendment, and I guess we have some concerns that it may be taking a system that has worked fairly well for our state for a number of years and modifying it for a limited number of cases. We looked at the number of aggravated durational departures, since that's what the court has said now is applicable to Blakely. And out of the 1,064 cases, we only had 243 last year that were contested durational departures. Now, I know the argument can be raised that there were departures that were sought and not granted, but they were looking at 243 cases out of 1,000 a year. That means changing a system that, you know, if there's cases warranted an aggravated departure, there is a bifurcated process, there is special jury instruction, there's different ways that can be handled. The majority of our aggravated departures fall under two crime categories, sex offenses and second-degree murder. The sex offenses have been addressed in several bills to enhance those penalties, which would probably make them cases that would not fall under this Blakely so much because of the different sentencing systems. So when you take all that in part, I guess the guidelines, when you start making the range 100% up like that, you lose certainty, you have a lot of disparity, issues like that, that the closer ranges do allow, and the departure should be for the atypical, extraordinary cases, and allowing that range to stay narrow controls that. It still gives the court and the prosecutor and defense the ability to depart on those cases where it's really warranted and there's extraordinary.
Any questions of this witness? Okay. Thank you, Ms. Toombs.
Thank you.
Okay, we will lay the bill over for possible inclusion and the omnibus bill. Next bill on the agenda for the day is House File 1298. Maybe. So we will move down the agenda to Representative Mullery, House File 1869.
Motion on the bill so we can get it before the committee.
I'll move the bill, Your Honor.
Thank you. Representative Ellison. Move the bill. It's before us.
Representative.
1869, cockfighting, dogfighting, and other
domestic animal fighting
criminal penalties imposed.
Mr. Chairman, would somebody move the 396B amendment?
Representative Ellison, so moved.
Thank you, Representative Ellison. Mr. Chairman, members, this issue came to me from a number of neighborhoods in North Minneapolis originally. There was a lot of concern. People were sometimes being attacked by fighting dogs that were trained as fighting, and there was also a lot of damage to other people's animals from these fighting dogs, because they were trained to go and try to kill other people's or any other dog. And it became a very heated problem on the north side. I believe it's also a problem of in St. Paul and certain areas north of the Twin Cities especially. Today we have Keith Streff. He's the animal officer for the Hennepin Humane Society and in charge of enforcing the statutes on this area of crime for the state of Minnesota, and I think he would be the best one to go into specifics on this. I believe he also is handing out some pictures of examples. Would be okay to...
All right. Sir, identify yourself again, and then please go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Keith Streff, and I am the director of the investigations for the Animal Humane Society based out of Golden Valley. I'm also a licensed peace officer and work part-time in various venues in outstate Minnesota as well. I think my primary focus on this, and having worked in this capacity for the better part of about 18 years. 34331 is the existing language that pertains to fighting dogs, and originally it was the only felony-related offense in the state of Minnesota for quite some time, where acts of egregious animal cruelty could be prosecuted under a felony penalty. What this does is amends that particular statute to enable law enforcement to effectively address these animals and these dogs prior to them committing or engaging into a more egregious activity such as this dog fighting. Currently, if we are working on a criminal case of a professional or even amateur dog fighting in or about the state, we have to actively catch them in the process of fighting before these animals can be seized subsequent to a criminal prosecution. So amending 34331 to allow for the paraphernalia and evidentiary material that indicates dogfighting activity would greatly enhance the law enforcement's ability to get these animals out of the hands before they transfer that aggression from animals to humans. I guess probably the most analogous example I can give in regards to law enforcement would be like that of a meth lab. Wouldn't make much sense if we couldn't arrest someone based on the materials that he had making meth inside of a homemade lab if we didn't catch him selling it first. So if he has the material and all the applications of methamphetamine manufacturing, that in itself is a crime. They would seize that particular paraphernalia and that material, and it would be used as evidence of a crime for making meth. Well, the same thing applies to these fighting dogs. Some of the pictures that are going around now, these are all actual cases that I've handled over the many years in regards to dog fighting. Some of these are a result of seizure in actual search warrants. So we take the dog and the information, but a lot of them also are from cases where we actually do some type of intervention when there is a fight in progress. But you can see the incredible amount of damage and the injuries that are incurred on these particular dogs. And from a perspective of public safety, there's very few people outside of the industry that really understand or realize the nature of the pit bull fighting dog. It's a dog unlike any other. It's a relatively young breed, 300 to 500 years old. It's been domesticated for the single sole purpose of fighting and eating and killing things. And it's directly bred to be animal aggressive. But as society has shown, if that particular animal is in a biotic community, that aggression is quickly diverted over to human aggression as well. And when that happens, these are the incidents that you normally see in the news and read about in the paper. So from a perspective of public safety, it's a pretty important issue as well, because we can circumvent tragedy by being able to grab these animals that are exhibiting these kind of conditions, where it's quite obvious that there's alternative activities going on other than just mixing it up with the neighborhood dog over territory. So with that, if you had an opportunity to read the take a look at these pictures, I'd be happy to answer your question.
Questions at this time, Representative Newman.
I think I understand pretty clearly what you're saying, but I don't disagree. But when I read page 2, line 7, it's conclusive that the dog has been trained or he's been trained to fight, if the dog is good at pressing the start. I will tell you, Representative, the reason why I have a black dog who just like a drunken Irishman, he loves nothing better than to fight. He'd rather fight than retrieve ducks. Now, I will tell you that under the definition of this particular bill, I would have been conclusively found guilty of a gross misdemeanor. So, then I go on to the language concerning possession of training apparatus and paraphernalia. Perhaps law enforcement officers would know what that is, but for instance, what a choker chain that I have used for decades in training my dog, he falls in that definition. And I'm simply pointing out, Representative Mulley, that the way this statute is written, I'm going to be afraid that I would fall way to found guilty or something.
Representative Mullery, and is it Officer Strip?
Strip.
I am looking at the language about wounds, etc. I also see the words after that dealing with possession of apparatus, paraphernalia, or drugs. I see the word "and" between those clauses. Tell us about what the "and" means and what kind of apparatus, paraphernalia, or drugs need to be included in this seizure.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Representative Newman, first of all, it's not just the fresh wounds coming from a drunken Irishman. 100% Irish. That's okay. I actually thought Jesse's one that everybody got worked up about. I thought that was funny. Wounds from fighting, and an expert such as Mr. Streff can tell the difference in there, first of all, and it's dependent on the whole basis, and I think it would be pretty easy, and also veterinarians are involved in this for testimony normally. And so I think it would be pretty easy also for you to have an affirmative defense, but Mr. Streff is specific.
Mr. Chair and Representative Newman, the statute is applicable more so for the fighting dog, or the pit bull, the breeds that are more specific in the fighting than any one or more characteristics of this particular issue would be indicative that there's a fighting issue in there, as well as it would be based on a formal complaint, which most of these fighting dogs situations are, and would also be a case where each individual case is judged on its own individual merits. So it would be a totality of the circumstances, if you will, where the apparatus that you see in the pictures now are forced treadmills and what they what we consider a conditioning or a passive treadmill where the dogs are continuously worked. So I think most veterinarians, which is what most criminal cases are going to be best on, is going to be professional opinion by investigators as well as veterinary professionals in the industry. Those particular injuries based on a dog that's been fought against another dog for territory or hierarchy are significantly different, as you can see in those photographs, than as a fighting dog. They fight from a different angle. They fight with more significant intrinsic injury. And usually, in most cases, if they've been fought in the ring, they don't live. So with that, the other photograph in there is some of the paraphernalia, the drugs, the blood doping, hypodermic needle, various muscle ligaments, performance enhancers, etc. are all in there.
Officer, what kind of performance enhancers by way of drugs?
Any of the anabolic steroids are most often swine, equine, and animal related, even the ones that are taken by humans.
I try to remember to call him an officer, and now I'm calling you that. Representative. You're welcome. That will tolerate, but only for so long.
To the point about this only applies to fighting dogs, I would simply point out the fact that there's nothing in here that I see that differentiates between a pit bull, you know, or a poodle. Secondly, while you do have in here an affirmative defense to prosecution, what that tells me is that if I get charged under this because my black life is fighting, I then have the responsibility of proving I wasn't using that dog for purposes of fighting. You've reversed the burden of proof here. Mm-hmm. And I just don't believe that I should be obligated to come forward with an affirmative defense. So, you know, again, those are just, this is the first I've seen this bill, the first that I've read it. And again, I acknowledge what you're trying to do. I think it's correct. We shouldn't allow that. But you're casting a, when I look at it, you're casting a really broad net. And in spirit, the story I told you about this pooch that I had, you might have gotten on that. So,
I just,
the way the bill is written, and the way the definition are serious. Yeah.
Response.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Newman, I don't know if you have a solution, but we have to do something about this. I've got a number of friends whose dogs have been killed after they complained, and they, you can't, I mean, these people don't send there and send out a notice when they're having a pit bull fight. But they do all of the training. The people, the neighbors know what's going on. If you're training them in certain ways, it can be seen. They're doing with the steroids and everything else on this. They're all caught up. They have they bring them into a garage, sometimes in a rug, whatever. 50 people suddenly converge on the garage, and it's not too hard to figure out what's going on. I've had a number of friends whose dogs were killed by these dogs, people who have been attacked by them, and everybody just says, well, we can't do anything under the law. And I think that this is, would be pretty hard to prove, and also that it's, I would think it'd be pretty easy affirmative defense that if you're not doing this, to just say that we can only charge them if we catch them right in the middle of a pit bull fight is just not the solution.
Representative Allison.
First of all, Representative Mullery, you and I live close by each other, and I agree with you that this is a problem. And, you know, but I would say that
The affirmative defense language in Section 5 may not be necessary because I think that I don't think the burden ever should be on the defendant to prove anything, but I think that the state should have to prove that the bird or the animal is being used with the intention of fighting it beyond a reasonable doubt. And so, I mean, I would tend to agree with Representative Newman, because I do think there is a burden shift under Subdivision 5. Maybe if we, I haven't looked at your bill close enough to know, but I think that as long as the burden, the state carried the burden and it was beyond a reasonable doubt, and that there was never any burden on the defendant to prove anything, I think that would definitely be a step in the right direction. I'd hate to see your bill not go forward simply because of Subdivision 5. And I think that if we were to eliminate the affirmative defense, then you know all of Minnesota and American law would shift the burden back on the state and to have to prove the case beyond a reasonable doubt and to prove the purpose of the animal and why it was being held. So those are just a few thoughts I thought I'd share.
Yes. Mr. Chair. So it has similar to this.
Yeah, a lot of it. Just a
Representative Mulroney.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Ellison, my understanding was that the burden in this bill is still on the state the way it's written now, because they have to prove the beyond a reasonable doubt everything. Then you can come back and show, despite all of their proof, that you're not doing it. So it seems to me that you still have the burden of beyond a reasonable doubt on the state. In fact, I think St. Paul has an ordinance much like the first part, and they don't even have the affirmative defense language in there. I guess I thought the affirmative defense was adding extra for the defendant, and that's why I wanted to put it in.
Representative Ellison.
I think that was a good intention, but I think that what it does is serves to do the opposite thing. Because if you look at line 14 on page 2, it is an affirmative defense to the prosecution if it is proven by the preponderance of the evidence that it suggests that somehow the defendant has to present a quantum of proof, which is preponderance of the evidence, that they have to do something. So, for instance, whereas in the ordinary prosecution, the burden is and remains with the state beyond a reasonable doubt. Even in affirmative defense or self-defense, the defendant never has to prove anything beyond by the preponderance of the evidence or anything. They just have to raise the issue. They have the burden of production, not proof. So the thing is that I think that by foisting upon the defendant any burden, even showing anything beyond by preponderance of the evidence, tends to shift a burden onto the defendant, which I don't think they have. Even in a, like I said, if you use a self-defense example, by just producing, just saying, hey, I'm just defending myself and having any reasonable facts to support that, that just means the state has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt you had no right to use self-defense. Not that you don't ever have to prove anything. So I think that the bill could be cleaned up. I just think that whenever you start saying that the defendant can or should have to prove anything in a criminal prosecution, we're running into deep water.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Mulroney.
I had put this in as the affirmative defense. I mean, if as a protection for the defendant, and I suppose would there be any problem with taking out the words "if it is proven by a preponderance of the evidence"?
Officer Schreff, have you ever watched Animal Cops?
I try not to.
Yeah, real.
Mr. Chair, have you ever watched the show Cops?
Actually, no. I watch Animal Cop.
Is any of that real?
I've
worked both sides of the street. But, sure, it's certainly a vein of accuracy and truthful, but it's made for television. There's some, a lot of dramatization in there, but I think the context is pretty accurate.
Most of those scenes, although some involve animal fighting, most of it's neglect or outright abuse. How many cases do you encounter a year, regardless of how you classify them? How many complaints do you have?
Mr. Chairman, my department will field somewhere between 3,000 and 4,000 calls for service, out of which I will actively work about 1,200 to 1,300 a year, out of which we'll probably do 400 some odd serious interventions and subsequent criminal investigations based on that.
So of those total 3,000 or 4,000 that you mentioned, how many are involved fighting in the animals?
I probably do anywhere from a dozen to two dozen actual pit bull fighting cases. But you have to remember, Minneapolis is a seasonal fighting state, unlike Missouri, Texas, Arkansas, the southern states where the active engagement professional dog fighters are. They don't like our winters, so they'll cycle out and they'll start coming. Matter of fact, right about April, right now is when we'll start seeing the pit bull fighters come back up from the south, and they'll be active in here again. So we're only about a 6-7 month fighting state. So if you do the math on it, it's probably as significant as any other one. It's just that we don't have the organized fighting here. Your amateur fight will last, one evening, and there might be 30-40 attendees, and we'll get on a typical intervention. If we do a search warrant, we'll run 30,000 to 50,000 in cash, a couple guns, 15-20 dogs, and 20 to 50 arrests. So comparatively, down south, there's a significant difference. But that isn't so much the problem; it's the spinoff. So you have the wannabe fighters, it's just, these dog fights that you see on TV, that's seriously dramatized, and we all talk about are those cases that are probably analogous to a large drug dealer. You don't get into a John Gotti every case. You deal with a street person that's very small on the totem pole, and the same as with these fighting dogs. And they're actually the serious part of this bill, because that's the fighter that gets tired of it, and he dumps the dog, it jumps across, it jumps the fence, runs loose, and eats the neighbor kid. And that's what we see in here on the 5 and 10 o'clock news. So if we have this dog that's exhibiting that particular evidence and can grab it before that happens, that's what this bill is all about.
Well, it's Representative Ellison, I rarely ask another rep to do a little work on somebody else's bill, but we've got a little bit of time. Bill, if you could see if you could bring some language back, or at least get it to my committee staff. We do have another rep, but I'm about ready to go over.
That's fine. Actually, Mr.
These our constituents ought to be getting their entertainment some other way. And these animals can't speak for themselves. So I think we ought to see if we can't clean up the bill if there's a problem and see what we can do with it. Representative Meslow.
Mr. Chair, I simply had what I think accomplishes that, but I can address that behind the scenes as well.
Why don't you see what you can do in the next day or two and then bring it back.
Sure.
Any further questions? Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mullery, when those 50 people get together in somebody's garage to watch, do they react?
Mr. Chair, Representative, absolutely, they wouldn't fight him without it. That's why I kind of find this ironic in regards to the welfare of the dog. This is a 50-50 spread. It's 50% for the welfare of the dog and 50% for the public safety. These dogs are they're a hand-raised, legalized weapon that once that conversion of aggression is turned from the animals to the humans, people, like I said earlier in this presentation, is that they aren't. These dogs are, they're bred, born, and raised for one thing, and that's to kill and eat things. No one really understands any other. If you're not in the industry, you don't really understand what these dogs are. And it kind of amazes me. Week after week, year after year, I see these cases where a person is interviewed on the news, and they say, "Well, it was unbelievable. I wonder, why did this dog do that?" Because that's what it's there for. I mean, that's like getting into a race car and going 150 miles an hour, and somebody says, "Boy, why did that car do that?" Because it was built to do that. So that's where the difference in them is. They tend to finish the job. So when they get somebody down, they usually finish it. Whereas most dogs, when they're down, they quit. They've won. And the pit bull wants to finish it. So it's a public safety issue as much as it is a dog issue.
Why do people watch?
Well, there's an entire gambling cottage industry behind that particular activity. Where you find one problem, you'll find a lot of problems. When we do these particular cases, we find drugs, we find guns, we find prostitutes, we find all these other issues that are going on at the dogfight. So it's one happy family.
Mr. Chair, maybe it should go to that committee on gambling and help the governor a little more.
Mr. Chairman.
Well, it's here now. I think we see what we can do. You know, clearly, I don't want to start pontificating about animals and such, but you know, a few years ago when we started on the health bill to allow the declaration of emergencies or martial law so that the governor could not only take care of a herd of cows, but take an inconceivable number of human beings off the street without any kind of strong enough controls, as I thought, you know. That may be one issue. And at that time, the argument still was that animals have no constitutional rights. So there's no such thing as animal rights. On the other hand, an animal does have a right not to be abused and not to be used in this fashion. So some way that we can extra language, and these gentlemen are going to work on it with you in the next day or two. Bring it back. Let's see what we can do with it. Representative Nelson, you have.
I basically have a comment, and the officer, I think, earlier hit it on the head about the being a public safety. 2 years ago, about this time, my mother's dog was attacked and killed on her back step by a pit bull that got let loose. The only thing that saved my mother was the fact that she had to put the dog down to get in the back door, and the animal that was attacking the neighbor kid attacked my mother's dog, and the police came out and actually had a shooter on her back step. So like I said, this is a public safety thing, and I think this is a good bill. Hopefully we can get the problems taken care of on it.
Anything else? Officer Scott.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'd like to add 34331, which is the amendment that we're attaching this bill to, works very well in its existing language, but they have now learned that through the popularity of this bill, the loophole is just not to get caught with this dog in a fight. Currently, I have to seize this dog if and when we catch him in a fight, and that's a very difficult covert operation to get that. We're lucky if we get, 1% might be an exaggeration on that, to get in there and get him on the fight. So when they come home from the fight, that's when the complaint comes in. The neighbor, the mailman, whomever sees a dog or gets a glimpse that runs through a window, it's a bloody mess such as the pictures that you're seeing there, and they say, and the complaint comes in and says, geez, I recognize this as a fighting dog, and this dog looks like it was just in a fight, you might want to go look at it. I go look at it, and the answer I get is exactly what Representative Newman said. Well, they ran across the street and got into a fight with a raccoon. And I write it up and leave. 2 weeks later, it jumps the fence and eats the kid next door. And I said, geez, I could have had that dog 2 weeks ago. So, and prevented that tragedy. But currently, the existing statute doesn't allow that. And I realize that there is some very strong language in here in regards to the constitutionality. I'm hoping we can work it out.
Let's see what we can do to get you the tool you're seeking here. If there's nothing further, the chair will lay this bill over. Aubrey, thank you. Representative Ellison.
House File 1715, Expungement Eligibility Expanded to Include Certain Criminal Proceedings Not Resolved in Petitioner's Favor. Just to announce to the audience that at this point we had planned to go to Representative Johnson's bill, but he is currently presenting a bill in Ways and Means. So we're going to give Representative Ellison the courtesy, since his is the last bill anyhow, to go now.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to move my bill and then immediately move to lay the bill on the table, but I would like the committee's indulgence to present some information and witnesses. I believe we talked about this earlier, Mr. Chair. So I will be moving at the end of our little presentation here. We'll be moving it to lay it on the table, not for inclusion, but just to lay it on the table because we want to get together with the county attorneys and other key stakeholders in order to discuss what could be a compromise position. Members, Minnesota law includes now and has included for quite a while a provision for expungement. In Minnesota, expungement does not mean erasing a criminal record. It means sealing it. It's maintained on file in the BCA. But if a person were to go up to the BCA or to the county court and look up a record, an expunged record wouldn't be there. Now, the process is long. It's involved. It gives all sides an opportunity to be heard. In fact, if I file a petition today, there will be 60 days by a statute that have to go by before I can ever have my petition for expungement heard. The day of my hearing, the court will take the matter under advisement, probably. And then, if the court rules in my favor, 60 more days will have to go by. And during that 60-day period, at post-hearing period, the order for expungement will be stayed, and allowing anybody to appeal it or to challenge it in any way they see fit. Now, Your Honor, your committee members and Mr. Chair, expungement is divided between two different areas. One is cases decided in favor of the defendant. We're not here to talk about those today. You can just move those off the table of your mind and place on there cases decided not in the defendant's favor. These are cases for which you may have a conviction, or you can have something called a 609-135 for dismissal. Any case in which the defendant somehow pleads guilty or is found guilty, even if the case is subsequently dismissed. In those cases, the 609A, the expungement statute, does contemplate a balancing between the competing interests. In effect, what you have to argue, what the petitioner has to argue, is that the burden imposed by the expungement is less than the benefit to the petitioner. And you make cases, you make arguments about rehabilitation, about how well you've done, how you completed treatment, things like that. Now that was working fine right up until the Court of Appeals came along and said, well, we have to have a separation of power. We have to recognize that there's a separation of power problem, that on one side of the fence you have the judiciary, the other side you have the legislature, and a judge who rules in favor of a petitioner for expungement can expunge court records, but has no authority to expunge executive branch records, which is the records that are held in the BCA. Now, that presents a problem because most people who are looking at you for a housing or a job are going to go right on down to the BCA because they have the records of everybody in the whole state. So what we're asking for in sum is that the court's judges be given authority to grant expungements for the purposes of cases that are decided in favor, not in favor of the defendant. So with that, what I'd like to do is introduce Mr. Geffen, who will testify on the bill as well. Mr. Geffen.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Geffen. I'm from the Middle Eight Office in St. Paul. About 4 years ago, my office was a single funded project or a single grant to help individuals who have the detrimental effects of a criminal history. Prior to that, we didn't see as an organization any need for a criminal expungement. Since then,
We have over 350 clients.
So we're seeing a tremendous
need in the area. As Representative Elsa discussed, we've seen a change in the last year. The court of appeals was almost exactly a year ago, which almost destroys any meaningful remedy an individual can get who is suffering from a conviction or a proceeding not resolved in their favor. So cases that are, you know, theoretically 35 years old still appear on VCA records and still preclude individuals otherwise qualified from obtaining employment and housing. We had initially proposed language in the signal proposed out, and it really was basically what we did was codify existing common law to give a statutory authority to the judges so they could include the DCA in their request to expunge. As Representative Pelson said, the DCA is not included, not a very meaningful remedy. The DCA's records, again, are a hub for the whole state. They're available online for $5. According to the Data Practices Act, they must sell data disks with a complete criminal history of the public record, roughly about $30. So these are the records that are so important to get out of this needing a remedy. And what we started with was a broad bill, and when we got some input, we met with prosecutors, we met with the DCA, and we started getting some feedback. We need to move to amend some of that language and change it. And what we came up with was, I believe, some really positive steps towards resolution on this. We initially created a list of prohibited expungements. This is not a situation where we're trying to help individuals who are continuing to commit crimes, just to find those individuals who are rehabilitated or success stories and are still suffering the detrimental effect of the record. So we added a list of prohibited offenses, which would be murder, the criminal sexual conduct, DWI, since they're manslaughter. At some levels, we've had manslaughter and serious assaults, I think, for the second degree. We've also added a provision whereby an individual with a gross misdemeanor or felony offense would be prohibited from even filing or asking for an expungement until 5 years after their release from the supervised release date, whether that would be released from probation or something else. So an individual commits a crime, has a 10-year probation, they still have to wait 5 years after the release of probation before they could even ask for an expungement. And we added a provision that would extend and give the judges the ability to include the DCA and executive branches in the judge's order to expunge. We also added a provision where the court would report the state court administrator cases where non-judicial records are sealed, so those could be exact. Goals of this legislation are not to impede law enforcement, their ability to investigate crimes, and not to assist individuals to avoid prosecution for offenses or receive a less severe sentence. The goal is to move back to the way we've had the expungement law for nearly a quarter century until this case came down in 2004, and also to give those individuals who are success stories again, people who have rehabilitated, the ability to find gainful employment and stable and safe housing.
Any members have any questions of either Representative Ellison or the presenter on this bill?
Yo.
Representative Corn.
An employee background check. Now, with this, if somebody expunged their record, say like a bus driver applying for a job, or we just recently had a bill, firearm safety instructors, getting the background check done on them, would they be able to, would the average Joe Blow be able to have his or her record expunged, and therefore you wouldn't be able to obtain that background if you did one of these checks? Or
under our bill, Mr. Chair, under our bill, Representative, what would happen is that on the conviction, if the conviction were for any prohibited offense, we have a list of offenses you simply cannot get a expungement for. Murder, sex offenses, things like that. Even DUI. You cannot, under our proposal, you cannot get an expungement for those things. So given your hypothetical, those records would always be there and would be available for the public. Now, if the person, say, for instance, in your scenario, had a conviction for disorderly conduct, a conviction, you know, went out to the Minnesota Gophers hockey game, got drunk, acted up, got arrested, then they got off probation, and then 5 years went by, and they applied for an expungement, and it was granted by the court, that person could receive an expungement.
Did you have a list of the offenses that you could get a... I'm sorry. Did you have a list of the offenses?
Mr. Chair, yeah. The list should be printed on the document that we just passed out. There should be... It should be there. I might...
Oh, it is this one.
Okay. Yeah.
I think if you look under... under section subdivision 3A subparagraph 2C, the list of offenses is there. Now, one of the reasons that we're not asking for a vote on this is that we want to continue to talk to law enforcement and prosecutors to figure out if we can get if we can come to a point of agreement on this issue, because we do realize the public has a right to know that certain people have committed certain offenses. But on the other side of the coin, at some point, our society should recognize people do change, redemption is possible, and particularly when we're talking about offenses that are drug offenses, certain property offenses, certain misdemeanor offenses, excluding DUIs, because they're enhanceable. We don't want to allow people to expose their DUIs, because if you do, what happens if they get another one within 10 years? Then they get to, you know, they get to a do-over, you know, which we don't want to allow them to have. They should, that DUI should be recognized, and it should be a basis for enhancement if it's exceptional intent. But in other cases, I mean, I think that we've got to realize as a society that people should get another chance. People should be able to reform. People should be able to work and be productive citizens if the offense that they committed was not extraordinarily heinous like the ones that we pointed out. If they have 5 years have passed since the end of their discharge of the case, and if they can prove to a judge that they have reformed and rehabilitated.
Anyone else have any other questions?
Mr.
I have forgotten your name.
John, yes.
Mr. Chair, Representative Quench, there is also a provision in the statute already about firearms that even with a successful expungement, you do not, you're not expunging your firearm restriction. For certain offenses, violent offenses, a lifetime prohibition against firearm ownership, and if an individual is able to receive an expungement on one of those offenses, the firearm restriction would remain in effect. I think the tricky part is just making it clear on how to make that available to the individual. But our intent is not to make that any less clear, and that is already in the statute.
Questions? Further questions?
Ellison.
So, I think we have another testifier, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Give your name and then proceed.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is John Kingery, speaking on behalf of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. Representative Ellison and I have had a chance on a couple of occasions to talk about this bill. I think it's clearly well-intended, trying to allow individuals to put their past behind them and to move on. And I think that's certainly the positive aspect of this bill. And the bill has been narrowed. I believe it's the amendment that we probably saw earlier this month. But I would just make four rather general comments. One, I think we need to continue narrowing the list of offenses that would be subject to this punishment process that's envisioned in the bill. Again, I'm going to base some of these offenses based on what I was told several weeks ago, and I'm going to assume this is what is in the amendment. For example, the number of offenses that would not be subject to this expungement process should include domestic abuse cases, indecent exposure, enhanceable, sex crimes, gang offenses. These are simply suggestions. Gun offenses, and criminal vehicular operation cases, and maybe look at that whole category of violent crimes in general. And I would see just like the kind of discussion that would take place during the interim. Another point is we want to make sure, even with cases that are sealed or expunged, that law enforcement always has access to these records. We just think that's very important in discussing this with various law enforcement officials. They hold that opinion as well. I think one of the things, I think that's why it's worthy or certainly valuable to work on this over the interim. There's a lot of misunderstanding in this area, and working through this, even on my side of the fence, folks had to be educated. I think a longer discussion would result in a better bill. The other comment that was made, again, as it relates to the amendments, is the feeling that it should be a longer waiting period. I think right now you envision 5 years. It's our belief that a longer period would be better. In my previous life, I used to actually staff the pardon board here. And I think the pardon board might be sure that part of the discussion in this area. And when I did staff the pardon board, I know those individuals, again, this is going back a number of years, they typically, and I'm not suggesting this as a time frame, but they typically waited for 15, 20 years before they came and got a pardon. Again, I'm not suggesting that, I'm just simply giving it to you as an example. So I think whatever you do in the expungement area, you might want to consider also what findings you might want to make in a pardon board procedure as well. With that, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm happy to answer any comments or respond to any comments.
Any questions of the witness? Any questions? Thank you.
Mr. Chair, can I ask a question?
Senator Ellison, please do.
Mr. Kingery, do you have any idea, what if we had a shorter period of time for non-felony offenses and then that longer period of time you're talking about for felony offenses? Is that something you'd be open to talking about?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Ellison, I believe that's a discussion that we would have over the interim. We might certainly consider a two-tiered process, certainly.
Thank you, Mr.
Chair. Yes. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kingery, I think you should think about what Representative Ellison said about people having trouble getting jobs. And if they have to wait too long, they will be 65. Then it's hard to get a job except at McDonald's.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, I agree with you. We hate to see impediments to individuals that have turned their lives around to getting appropriate housing and jobs and so forth. In terms of the individuals that would work on this case or work on this over the interim, I would include certainly representatives from the BCA, from our criminal system, as well as the courts as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very good. The chair will lay the bill over.
Not at this time. We'll take
further testimony.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Richard Neumeister. I would like to say, Mr. Chairman, I think it's a great idea that it be done over a period of the interim. As a number of your committee members and yourself knows, the issue of expungement, whether it be in DNA or even some of the things some of your committee has discussed, are very important ones to take a look at expungement. Particularly in the area of arrest and police records that are kept, whether it be on computer or other kinds of things. So if at your direction and other folks are going to voluntarily do some things on expungement over the interim, I would encourage that they include all kinds of folks, not just the court personnel, not just the police or whatever, but citizens and the kinds of things that this affects. We have done these kinds of studies before on background checks and all that through the policy task force dealing with criminal justice information. And if you include everybody, you usually can resolve a good thing. It comes back to the legislature, and those kinds of things usually are passed. So I would encourage that. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you very much. And I do support the premise and the concept of the bill.
Thank you for your time. Your laser is still over. All right, we are, listen very carefully, we are going to complete this calendar tonight, shortly.
Good.
Yes. We have an author that wants to collect himself, and I need some paper shuffled, so we're taking a 10-minute recess. You all can take a breather. 10 minutes recess.
Okay.
Back here 9 and a half.
And what?
Okay. I gotta go find where I put all my stuff.
And then I'm taking out schedule 5.
Is there a bill left here? No, but is there a bill left for here?
Just, yeah, it was just the amendment on the...
I think he went on.
With the log and photo ID and age restriction. It needs to be totally reworked. That amendment made that garbage even worse.
If I have to bet.
So Judy Cook is smart.
I hope so. So convenience stores and gas stations and that can now still sell them.
I have a list.
And before, the way we heard it, would it be only drugstores?
Likely candidate.
Sure, we
haven't been approved, so. Thank you, I'll get to the bottom.
Okay. Sorry. I'm thinking of
So convenience stores and drug stores and grocery stores can sell them behind the counter.
What the rest?
I mean, convenience stores, gas stations.
Yeah, anybody.
Anybody can sell them as long as they're behind the counter. Yeah.
So it's just nothing. Where do I need to
remember?
Nothing.
Well, before, when we heard it, it had to be a class, there had to be a drugstore or somebody that worked in the drugstore. Or whatever.
That's what I wanted.
Had
to be just pharmacy.
I don't want it.
Shouldn't it go to pantries too? Because it's going to pensions and we're fine.
Oh, whoops, I'm sorry.
Wasn't there another bill?
Yeah.
Or
rule-based
funding.
Upstairs, right here. 1880.
The German was King Kong and the exec board. Don't have a from my cell anymore.
From the German?
You know, she's not even
eligible. No, I've got that amendment done.
I was asking Andy, he thought next
Well, he was lobbying for the court amendments
here. All I had to do was change the
agreement.
Yeah. I have a That's the one they didn't. I don't remember from memory.
Are you going home now?
Yes, mom. And then they asked what the difference is. Huh? Yeah, they made copies and went around. Luckily, there was only
one. That should be fun to see, too.
I was trying to find it, but.
I'll let Helen know, too,
Robert. Okay, nice day in here.
Yeah. That's right. We'll work out.
Thank you. Let me know what you need.
Town. Hi.
They didn't look at the other one either. They didn't look at the original.
No, they did. Oh.
Research summary will be there when I go up after committee and print them out.
What's that? No.
Mine will be there.
A fair number of them will be, actually, because Becky did them. So they'll be, and I should be able to, you know, if we get done here by. Yeah, that's a good point, too. I got to do some more this afternoon, tomorrow afternoon. I'll look at the agenda and try to get the ones earlier. It was good. I kicked my M6. I needed a waiver to get in, actually. I was older than where that?
Oh, I was 30, yeah.
See, you join us, you can get more people like Jeff.
Let's up that age.
You'd think it'd be easy if not to get in.
I thought my dice never worked. Somebody needs me to be seen. What's up? I have an answer.
They have their own way of doing things over there.
I can't move, and I was trying to go get stuff.
That would take more than I'm capable of. Let me handle that.
Okay. Not that one too? Well, that's been changed, but
knit the ones above the knee and still do the attempt. We could move it to maybe a 12-month.
Yes, you're even taking a break to wait.
Everyone waits.
Can I just follow you around the legislature some more today, Jeff? Because I don't think it's going to happen.
Right now, it's a question. Squeaky.
Need some oil. That, I'm partly guilty because my initials are on it.
Right, but that was only one of the people.
Sure. So when I go out there, some talked about how the Schedule 5 stuff is drafted, it should be, where it should be. That just makes it even worse.
Whether
they do it.
Either on the phone or in court to say, hey, you got to correct this. Lobbying for the PA-33 after the logging and the idea that it just, they were trying to do a backdoor run around it. And they they lost the whole value of that amendment by that. Now you got gas stations that have to have a log to sell two tablets. It's worse
as well. We could have.
Well,
here's the penalties if you don't allow little boys.
No, I didn't write it out. It came to me that I improved it to the extent
we don't tie.
That's what they wanted. They wanted to vote on that.
Yeah.
So it came to me drafted, and then I fixed what I could in that as it was placed. Just like compounding layer on layer of bad. We'll check there. Well, that was a bigger debate. They were just trying to pin Knobloch down.
And the transfer accounting thing that
do that every year.
We could tweet it down the road if we need to.
More states are actually going to.
But get away from it.
I'm going to go shake a few of them and say, we're paying for that. It's not an unfunded, that's not the unfunded portion of anything.
It works if we don't do something. Yeah.
We have a pretty
long the problem.
That's where we've given the judge. When we first got this bill, it was
36.
We've gone away from it. We do recognize.
We've had different pieces of policy. It's supposed to be tracked.
Oh, ma'am, who knows?
Floating around.
We dropped you back from the court.
Which student did we drop? I don't know.
498 Association's action. Holberg's.
From tomorrow?
Yeah,
410. I'm right on that, I'll be in.
Because I know my members are like, I am expert. I don't know anything right now. I'm so ineffective at my after speech, but that's okay. They'll live.
But we're just looking to get to the table with the Senate.
Got a voicemail. That's okay. He didn't offer it, so. Because it's already important. There's still some discussion.
Willing to 30? No, the 30 max is always. Yeah, for the. Yep. They usually go about 6.5 years if they're first time.
Oh, 14. Right.
That might be the statute that took it from. I don't see any stat max.
Yeah, and I'm
things with trying to get the mandatory minimum. Stat max. But the, I think that's tied into the existing penalty. It's tied in, they have the structure where subdivision 3 is the penalty provision, and then they shoehorned the separate crime. Possession with the precursors with intent to manufacture. And they use the existing penalty.
I'm trying to get through it tonight.
Different penalties.
If you could just email the chairman
what everything means.
Yeah, they've kind of...
things are... who's agreeable to the language, who's still not agreeable to the language, what it does, how much it raises, where it spends it. So, I mean, we're obviously going to have to get a fiscal note on the bill. It's going to have to travel to these committees. The one thing that's my responsibility is making sure it's caring what's going on with the bill.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, I think it will. It won't be.
Will
be. I'll be happy to tell you when it went on. And
I don't know if that's the right name, but that's what I
say that this went on in
close enough
late, late 90s, early 2000s.
Thanks for that brief break.
Existing penalty was 30. That was the first
after me.
For first degree possession or possession of sale. Whatever level
yep.
those are.
Go back into session here at this point. We're going to take House File 1881, Johnson J. Local correctional fees provided.
Mr. Chairman, I will move House File 1880 below the possible inclusion in the House.
Yes.
Okay. This is of the two, I think, the easier and probably quicker bill. It amends the provision in current law that authorizes the local jail to collect local correctional fees money from convicted offenders, and it authorizes facilities now to charge fees to persons who are under the control and supervision of the facility, which is a bit broader. And rather than me talking about it, I do have a testifying very briefly explaining that.
Okay.
Chairman members, thank you. Ron Weber, Justice Kennel. Leader Park Representative Johnson
about this bill.
The reason we're requesting the language change is that in Hennepin we get about between 275 and 300 cases a year where people are charged with a crime, taken to court, convicted, but then they are continued without prosecution
or continued for
the court in essence stays the adjudication, says do some community service, make restitution to the victim,
and we'll just forget this ever happened.
Well, they are put under our supervision by the court.
So that these conditions
are in fact monitored.
And we have to spend as much time, if not more,
monitoring the conditions of
these folks as we do on those convictions.
So it would just make it easier
for everybody
if we would remove the words convicted of a crime
so that it does include these people that that are continued without prosecution or continued prosecution. Questions? Anyone else wanting to be heard on this bill?
Chair lays the bill over.
Possible inclusion.
Thank you.
Let's go to 19, House File 1298. Video game purchase or rental in certain instances by children under the age of 17 prohibited and penalties provided.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to move House File 1218 be recommended to pass and sent to the or placed on the general register, or depending upon the conversation, we could send it on without recommendation, which might be a possibility.
We do.
Okay, we have an motion in the alternative.
I'll make the motion to send it without recommendation.
That's the motion on deck. Go ahead.
All right, I will. I've got that spill. Great testimony here, and I'll skip much of it because it's late. But this is a pretty simple, straightforward bill dealing with what I think most people would consider very violent or in some cases very sexually explicit video games that are rated M for mature, which is the definition of that is not suitable for children under the age of 17, or AO for adults only. And I still haven't seen one of those. I don't even know if they exist. But really, bottom line, this is for M for mature video games. And essentially what the bill says is that a child under 17 cannot rent or buy an M or an AO rated video game. If they do, they are guilty of a petty misdemeanor. They're subject to a $25 fine. And the retailers that sell or rent these need to put up a sign to that effect. Mr. Chairman, my intent is not to arrest these children or to make money for the state $25 at a time. I suspect there will be very little or none of that. What I am hopeful to do if this bill passes into law, particularly with respect to the signs, is it may give at least a few kids who are regularly buying or renting these pause before they do it. It will put pressure on the retailers who are not voluntarily enforcing the 17-year-old requirement to do so, and I will tell you that a lot of retailers, probably most retailers, already do that, and I appreciate that, but all of them don't. And then maybe most importantly, it will catch the attention of maybe a few painfully oblivious parents to take note of what their kids are looking at, because this stuff is unbelievably, some of it's unbelievably harmful and sickening in my opinion. A couple of people in my own party have called this a nanny state bill. It's not. I don't offer those. I don't vote for bills that require a parent to put on life vests for their kids, or require motorcycle helmets or smoking bans. This bill places absolutely no limitations whatsoever on adults or on kids that are 17 or 18 years old. And I think it's far from the nanny state to say that children can't rent or buy adult video games, some of which are absolutely horrific. They can play them, but somebody who is 17 or older needs to either buy or rent them for them, whether it's a big brother, a sister, a neighbor, or a parent. I've had lots of people call asking to testify on this bill. I told them all no. So what I would like is just to give you a few examples and then play for you a 2-minute and 30-second video. First of all, I could spend a lot of time giving you what is some pretty clear evidence of a connection between child violence and murder in some cases in violent video games. If you Google Columbine, or if you Google the Paducah school shootings, or if you Google the John Lee Malvo, the 17-year-old sniper out in D.C., and also put in violent video games, you are going to find more documents than you can imagine, and the list will go on and on and on. I do not claim that M videos are responsible for kids killing people. They don't turn angels into monsters. But when you have at-risk kids, you couple it with all the violence that we already have in our society, and then you give them these very realistic, very graphic training tools that glorify murder in some cases, especially of cops in some cases. You get points by killing innocent people in a lot of these games. The results are a little bit scary. Let me just give you a couple of examples of what I found on the Internet. I did a search, and this literally took me less than 2 minutes to find this site called 100 Most Violent Video Games. This is not put out by some do-gooder group that doesn't like violent video games. This is put out by some people who wanted to rate the most violent video games so people would go rent them because they think they're kind of cool. And I've got lots of highlights. Let me just read a very few of them for you. The most popular video game series in the world, I think in all of history, is the Grand Theft Auto series. And I've got little kids in my son's school in first and second grade who are playing the Grand Theft Auto series. Let me just give you a couple thoughts about what these guys say about the Grand Theft Auto game. How many different ways can you murder innocent people? You can get very creative with the games, with the kills in these games, and that's how you get points, by killing innocent people. In part three, there was a gore code that allowed you to shoot off arms and legs and pop people's heads apart in bloody mess. You could run people over or beat them with a bat until they were drowning in blood. You could also, I'm going to change some of the words here, have sex with hookers and then murder them to get your money back. You get more points that way. Or you could kill people until an ambulance arrives, then use it to ironically run over more people and kill them. Running over someone's head caused it to pop with a nasty crunching sound under your tire and leave a long bloody trail behind you. The best part was that you could do all this to innocent people. There was even a record-keeping pause screen telling you how many people you killed. My body count was over 44,000 in Vice City. Another game called the Silent Kill series. Not only can you spill blood from your enemies with weapons like axes and hammers, but sometimes entire rooms were covered in blood. Throughout rooms, you would find decapitated bodies or torsos mangled up into disturbing imagery. Sometimes you could even come upon severed body parts or dead babies. In the distance, you could hear screams and sounds of torture and murder as the ceiling would bleed. The Clock Tower series, a point-and-click survival horror game with little girls being chased by murderers, killing all their friends and family members. These games feature multiple endings. For example, Part 2 gives you 13 different endings, and the little girl only survives in one of them. Clock Tower 3 shows a little girl with pigtails get her head smashed apart against a wall with a huge sledgehammer by a murderer who continues to smash her head everywhere. Later, you see her as a ghost covered in blood playing a piano while her father is being impaled onto a fence. One cinema shows the killer gouging out a man's eyeballs and laying his mother into a vat of acid as she suffers and boils to death. Another game called Postal, an ultra-violent murder simulation shown from an overhead view, allowing you to play as a sex hotline dialing serial killer, angry because his house got repossessed. You can visit construction sites, parades, and schools, unloading machine gun ammo and rockets at innocent people, sending them flying back with blood pouring out of their wounds. People with suffering cries, they were being murdered, losing a fatal amount of blood, invading, can you kill them, saying things like, I can't breathe, I can't see anything, kill me now. You can then go put a gun to their head and fill it full of blood, saying, going, going, gone, or, ah, that hurt. And you can also burn people to death as they ran around, etc.
The Carmageddon series, a driving game where you can kill the people you're racing against. If your car gets screwed up, you can buy new parts to repair it by earning points, and the way you earn points is by killing pedestrians. The glorious part of the game was running over hospital patients for bonus points. You could even kill pregnant women and mothers pushing strollers. Manhunt, that's a pretty popular game that I think has actually been banned in countries, although it's at Blockbuster. I saw it. You can rent it. It had at least 10 different weapons with 3 different fatalities for each one. An axe, machete, and meat cleaver let you hacklade your victim's neck with 3 hard swings, causing the head to fall off. You could also take piano wire and grab a guy from behind, sawing his neck back and forth, pushing against him with your foot until the head fell off. One of the most popular ones...
Agonist in this game is a guy who paints his face up like a clown.
You could suffocate people with plastic bags and then stab and push shards of glass into their eyeballs. I could go on and on. Let me go to the last game. Postal 2 and Apocalypse Weekend. In this game, you can brutally murder innocent people in a variety of ways. The graphics are outstanding. The people look and behave very realistically. You can kick someone to death over and over
against the wall,
smashing them against the floor. You can chop off their heads with a shovel and play soccer with the head, swinging the shovel, sending the head and the body bouncing all over the place. The bodies don't fade away either, so you can stack corpses into a huge pile of up to 200. You can urinate all over people, even into their mouths, or you can shock them with a taser until they go into twitching convulsions, urinating their own pants down the chimney. You can urinate in a gay guy's mouth. He'll enjoy it. If you urinate in a cop's donut, he'll throw up, allowing you a free shot at his head with a shotgun. There are even marching parades you can unload on, like a gay pride march, a minority parade, and a cop parade. You can douse victims in gasoline or create a gas trail leading to the victim and burn them to death. And all this happens to civilians and innocent people minding their own business. There's no limit to what you can do. I skipped a lot. But I want to show you a 2-minute and 30-second video. And I'm going to warn you
that it's rather graphic. Yes.
Before we may have questions before we get to the video.
And let me tell you something about the video. First of all, don't worry.
It does not contain the most horrifically graphic
violence, although it's fairly violent. It contains some very
strong language, and then there are scenes from 2 of the most popular games out right now. One's called Guy Games, and one's called Leisure Suit Larry that has very explicit sex in it. These are all rated M games
that kids right now can buy or rent.
A 7-year-old or a 9-year-old or a 15-year-old could go.
We do have questions here. I have a couple I would ask first, and that is, let's lay a little groundwork for what a petty misdemeanor is. Since this is aimed at 17 and younger, and under the age of 17, so a 17-year-old or a 16-year-old is issued a petty misdemeanor, is there any kind of a juvenile record that occurs at that time?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know the answer to that question, but maybe Mr. Diebel.
Mr. Chairman, members, I don't think that would be on their record. It wouldn't be a criminal offense.
Help me out with what a petty misdemeanor is. For example, in this case, how long would... Tell us what a petty misdemeanor is.
Mr. Chairman, members, it's essentially a tab charge of a ticket, and so there's no... penal consequences. It's a quasi-criminal penalty.
Is there a, Mr. Diebel, is there a period of time in which the penalty would have to be paid?
Mr. Chair and members, typically, yes, just like a traffic ticket is a petty misdemeanor. The 30-day, perhaps.
What happens, Mr. Diebel, if the 16-year-old receives the petty misdemeanor charge and then out of embarrassment or whatever reason throws it away and doesn't tell his parents? What happens? Is there an expiration date? In other words, at what point is there a warrant out for the person's arrest, if any?
Mr. Chair, I'm not certain as to the automatic triggering effect of not paying the fine. I suspect that a law enforcement could seek a warrant if they didn't pay the fine, just like you could for not paying parking tickets.
So what I'm hearing you say is that if the petty misdemeanor fine of $25, not more than, is not paid, it could lead to an arrest warrant against a 16-year-old?
Mr. Chair and members, I suspect that could be a result.
A couple other questions. The what is the ESRB, Representative?
it is a ratings board that rates the videos, and I actually believe they may have a representative.
So they would be, we would, as a legislature, rely on their rating? If they rate something AO or M, then if this were bill were to become law, if the ESRB rates a video as AO or M, that would put it in the category of subject to a petty misdemeanor?
Yes, exactly.
What's your answer to the suggestion that that would be a delegation of legislative authority to a non-elected body?
Mr. Chairman, my answer to that is if there is a better way to get at this, and to figure out a way to explain video games that we don't want our kids to rent or buy on their own, I am happy to do that. But these are pretty widely recognized and accepted ratings by places like Blockbuster and Best Buy, and it's the best I can come up with.
What is the origin of ESRB? You know,
I don't know, but I guess it's someone can testify to that.
We have Representatives Hamer, then Ellison, then Murphy. Representative
Hamer. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Johnson, we've had similar bills like this on violent video games in the past. And I just want to know what the research says and what you've been able to find about the influence or the impact of violent video games actually on young people, sexual violence or violence in general.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Paymar, there's going to be a dispute depending upon who you talk to. There are plenty of studies out there, as well as scholars and doctors who have written material, much of it that I've taken off the internet and read, where there is convincing evidence that there is a connection. Again, not that being obsessed with a violent video game all by itself makes somebody go and kill someone or commit rape or whatever. But that especially when you have a child who is at risk because of some other factor, and they become obsessed with these things, it becomes something that either makes them more violent, or in some cases, it trains them. We saw that in the Paducah school shootings. This kid, who was 14, was obsessed with, I can't remember whether it was Doom or one of the other games, where it's a first-person game, so you're not shooting and watching yourself shoot. You're actually the head behind the screen. You see your hands right here. And you're learning to shoot it at point blank, and if you shoot in the head, you get more points. And he went into a school and fired 8 shots and had 8 hits. I believe 5 of them, maybe 3 of them in the head and 5 in the upper torso. He had never shot a shotgun in his life. And the police commander down there said that's the most amazing thing he'd ever seen.
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, so by extension then, I suppose the research would say that watching television and hundreds of deaths every day and night and the horrific acts that we see on television, even without cable, are you also making the claim, or are researchers saying that that also influences young people to act out in a violent, sexual or violent way?
Mr. Chairman, certainly there are researchers who say that can contribute. I think that, however, watching a very gory or violent movie is very different from sitting on a video and getting behind the kill on yourself and getting points for doing it and doing it in the first person. And most of the research that I have seen has said all the violence in society contributes to this. And we would never consider blaming it on this one thing, because I think it's going too far. But this probably more than other forms of media is going to have an effect on that.
Thank you.
Representative Ellison. And I know I started the questioning off, but it may have been a little unfair because the author wanted the tape. So go ahead with your questions.
You know, Mr. Chair, I was going to withhold my substantive questions and only talk about the questions you were asking about what is a petty misdemeanor, if that would help the committee.
If there's no objection, I'm going to suspend this point. Let's go to your video so you can set the stage. And then we'll get back to Representative Ellison and Murphy.
What this is that it's called the video, I can't remember what the name of it is, but there's a group, a national group right here in the Twin Cities that looks at video game violence. Every year they put out a video report card. These are simply snippets. The most popular rated M things. These are not ones you've got to go
go far to find. And then at the end, there's a little 30-second public service announcement that they put on at the minute CFTV.
Same old CJ. Buster. Straight Buster. Oh, shit. Run. Now, listen to these motherfuckers. Come on, faster. Ice them, CJ. Let's hunt down some more.
Enjoy showing that, but that's what our kids are watching. And so we ought to see it.
Ready? Representative Ellison.
I was going to say, Mr. Chair, I do believe that a petty misdemeanor is for adults is an offense for which there's no possible jail, but you can get up to a $300 fine.
And it's an offense that does stay on your record for a juvenile. It does stay on your record as well. It depends. The court could stay adjudication, which could preserve your record, but they need not do that. So I just thought I'd share that with the committee. My substantive question is as follows. Do you expect a court challenge if your bill's passed into law?
Representative Johnson.
I would be very surprised if there wasn't one. There is case law out there where courts outside of Minnesota have said that other restrictions on violent videos have not been constitutional. I can distinguish each of them for you if you want, as you could do if you put your mind to it. My thought is with something like this, when the Supreme Court tells me this is unconstitutional, I'll drop the case, but they haven't. And I mean, if we can't put restrictions on that, I don't know what to say.
Mr. Chair, it's clearly offensive and extremely poor taste and all those things. I mean, I agree with you on that. But isn't this something, I mean, if there's no proof clearly that this does cause a violent behavior, isn't it something that maybe we should let parents regulate? There is a rating system, and maybe we should let the parents handle this.
Representative Johnson.
Absolutely. That's part of the point of this bill. If a parent wants to rent or buy one of these, or if a parent wants to let their kids play it, this bill doesn't address that at all. What this bill says is that a kid under 17 can't go in and do it him or herself. In most cases, I would assume without the parent of knowing why.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Allison.
Now, the bill punishes the kid if the kid buys the video. What happens to the retailer or shopkeeper if they sell them the video?
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chairman, under my bill, nothing. What the bill does is that it requires them to put up a sign. Hopefully, those that aren't voluntarily already enforcing this ratings will hopefully start doing it. I know where you're going because I completely understand what you're saying. Maybe we shouldn't be punishing or making a criminal out of the kid. Maybe we should do it for the adult or maybe the other kid who's lending it to him. Frankly, my purpose in this is to get more than anything else, get the attention of the parents by forcing them. And the political realities would suggest that this is the better way to go.
Mr. Chair, if a clerk sells my kid cigarettes, clerk's going to be on the hook. That's just a comment. Is this going to cost us anything? I mean, is there money involved? I guess I'm thinking of enforcement costs, perhaps defending a lawsuit cost. Do you have a fiscal note? And what do you envision the expense to be?
Is that objection?
I don't have a fiscal note. I am doubtful that there would be a cost to this because I can't imagine the police spending. More than anything else, it's to raise awareness and send a message and put people on notice. Could there be an incidental cost for a city? I suppose.
Last question, Mr.
Representative Allison.
Juvenile crime, as I look at it, and I look at the statistics, has been declining for the past, 10 years or so. Doesn't that indicate to us that perhaps this and these video games are getting more popular every year? Doesn't that indicate to us that maybe they don't cause violent behavior among youth? I mean, in your view, what if anything should be learned from declining juvenile violent crime rates? Red Lake notwithstanding, and what they have to tell us about the dangerousness of these kind of videos.
Representative Johnson.
I don't know what lesson to take out of that. All I know is that you look at the most heinous and the most violent of the crimes, and it's really hard to find one where the kid hasn't been assessed with violent video games. And we have now heard that about Red Lake. I heard it in the Miami press. Jeffrey Weiss's friend said he was constantly changed. Whether that's true or not, I shouldn't even say it, but I read it in the Miami press. So, point well taken, but I think there must be some sort of relationship.
Representative Murphy.
Well, Mr. Chair, I raised my hand when you were asking the questions about petty misdemeanor and the 17-year-old or the 16-year-old. What about the 7-year-old or the 8-year-old that attempts to go and maybe they heard of a good game and they go in the shop and they ask to purchase the game? And so that person is going to have a misdemeanor? They don't have the judgment. Petty misdemeanor?
You want to respond, Representative Johnson?
They could be guilty of a petty misdemeanor. I hope it would be historical. If they don't have the judgment, not to do that, do they have the judgment? And these are not, again, these are the popular games, not the outliers.
But Mr. Chair, it's already been said that it seems to me that the person that's selling the product should be the one that is given the fine or given the... You can have the sign up, fine, but to make the person that might want to buy it because he heard something or she heard something about what a good game this was or something and turn him into a...
To open an account.
A criminal. I don't know.
Representative Johnson, I'll show my ignorance. Do you need a credit card to open an account at a movie gallery or any other video rental places?
Mr. Chairman, I believe you probably do. At least that's been my experience.
If there's no other questions, we have some contra testimony. Maybe we can go with that. I'm sorry, Representative Cornish.
The Mr. Chair, members, is there anything in effect now? I mean, could you go after the parents for allowing them to rent them or watch them? I mean, we've got laws like it's illegal to allow the illegal operation of a ATV by a juvenile if you're the owner, the operator, and the same as a motorboat and certain things. Do we have any way of going after the parents if they would allow them? Or is there any existing law now that segregates, like X-rated movies, when you go in you'll see a sign section only 18 allowed in here or something? Is there anything like that for these?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cornish, there is not. And I don't think to be honest, I don't think I'd want one. I mean, my thought is if a parent wants to let their kid do this, they can let their kid do this. It's probably none of my business. The question is when the kid wants to do it, presumably without the parent knowing. I do have some problems. And with the X-rated videos, there's where your constitutional issue gets sticky, because it's pretty clear with sexually explicit material that you can restrict youth access without violating the Constitution. The question comes with excessively violent material and how you define it.
Let's go to the testimony. Thank you, Representative Johnson. I believe you've had about 25 minutes of testimony, so I'd like to give equal time to the other side. Perhaps we can try to stay with limits. Thank you. Give us your name and then proceed.
Sally Jefferson. I'm here on behalf of the Entertainment Software Association. The ESA represents the U.S.-based companies that publish video games. We account for over 90% of the video game sales in this country. Our members include Electronic Arts, Microsoft, Sony, as well as THQ, Activision, and Vivendi Universal, which have facilities here in the state. I greatly appreciate the opportunity to testify today. The ESA opposes House File 1298 for three reasons. First, the proposal is unnecessary because the video game industry has created a very successful self-regulatory program through the ESRB, which we talked about here previously. The ESRB rates these products and provide information to consumers as well as works with retailers in support of enforcing the rating system. And I'm joined by Marie Sella, who will talk about their perspective and what the retailers are doing on this front. Secondly, the proposal is unconstitutional because it restricts a minor's access to video games that are neither obscene nor harmful under Minnesota law or the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. Third, similar restrictions have been found to violate due process by unlawfully delegating legislative power to a private trade association. Specifically about the ESRB, It is a voluntary rating system. It was created soon after the ESA was created, and it was created back in 1994. It provides consumers with information, ratings that are based on age appropriateness of games, as well as content of those video games. The system is recognized by the Federal Trade Commission as being the most comprehensive entertainment rating system for any entertainment medium in this country. And most recently, the Kaiser Family Foundation released a national survey of parents that found that the ESRB system is the most useful of all the entertainment rating systems. The ESRB issues 6 age-based categories. I believe you all have this information. And they run from EC, which is early childhood, 3 years and older, to AO, which is adults only, suitable for adults 18 years and older. I do want to point out we've created a new category the ESRB has. It's called Everyone Plus 10. So it's for games or for ages 10 years and older, and that was established about a month ago. The ratings are supplemented by short phrases that are called descriptors, and there are about over 30 of these descriptors, and on the back of the card you'll see them listed. And those will maybe be found on the back of every game. Together, the ratings and the descriptors provide advanced information for consumers and adults to make an informed purchase decision for their families. And educating adults is key here. According to the Federal Trade Commission, adults are involved in the purchase or rental of a video game more than 8 out of 10 times. And our industry data shows that actually adults are involved in the purchase and rental of a game over 90% of the time. And that's not really surprising, since the average age of a video game player is 30 years old. The average age of a video game buyer is 36 years old. And again, you know, the costs of these video games run anywhere from $40 to $60 a piece, which is a lot of money, and I don't know many kids that have that kind of money. And again, there's also a misperception that violent video games dominate the games that are on the market right now. Look at sales figures for last year show there are a broad array of family-friendly titles. In 2004, 13 out of the top 20 best-selling games were rated E for everyone. 2 were rated T for teen, and 5 were rated mature. In total, 82% of the games sold last year were rated E or T, which is everyone or teen, and about 16% were rated mature. In addition, we respectfully submit that the constitutional issues raised by this legislation are very serious. Video games are protected speech, receiving the same First Amendment protection as movies, books, and music. And as such, every court that has looked at this issue has held that the government may not impose a content-based legal burden, either through criminal or civil sanctions, on video games. Additionally, the courts have never upheld restrictions on a minor's access to R, NC-17, or X-rated movies, nor have they upheld restrictions as it relates to M or AO-rated video games. There are no laws in effect that mandate the enforcement of either the motion picture industry's ratings or the ESRB ratings. And it's important to note the ESRB ratings, an M or an AO, are advisory. They are not a legal determination that the video game is obscene or harmful to minors. In addition, any attempt to prohibit a minor's access to video games based on its rating or depictions of violence will not survive judicial review. And I would like to add here, and I'll try to wrap here very quickly, there has been some mention and talk about the research about the impact of video games and violent behavior. And I want to caution you, there is no consensus on this front. And it's important to look at what the U.S. Surgeon General, the FBI, and others have said. In 2001, the U.S. Surgeon General released a report on youth violence, finding that youth violence is caused by numerous factors and targets lifestyle decisions, such as gangs, guns, and drugs as the main culprits. The Surgeon General also stated it was extremely difficult to distinguish between the relatively small long-term effects of exposure to media violence and those of other influences. A report prepared by the FBI entitled Lessons Learned listed 30 factors as indicators of violent acts by youth, such as low self-esteem, fascination with firearms, and lack of family support. It did not list playing video games. In 2000, the Washington State Department of Health conducted a comprehensive study. They concluded that the research evidence is not supportive of a major public concern that violent video games lead to real-life violence. Last summer, Dr. Olson, a professor of psychiatry at the Harvard Medical School, wrote in the Journal of Academic Psychiatry about serious flaws in existing video game research and concluded, quote, "It's time to move beyond blanket condemnations and frightening anecdotes and focus on developing targeted educational and policy interventions based on solid data," end quote. Given the Journal of the American Medical Association published research last fall, finding that, quote, "Consensus is lacking on whether video games with violent content fuel aggressive behavior in children and adolescents," end quote. Finally, every court that has looked at this issue has said that the research does not establish a compelling state interest justifying legislation. In conclusion, the video game, as we talked about, has an excellent rating system. We are committed to working with retailers to encourage their voluntary enforcement of it, and also educating consumers about the rating system so they can make informed purchase decisions. We stand ready to work with you in developing creative and effective educational programs to ensure that parents, who are the buyers of the vast majority of games for kids, use the tools available to them to make the right decisions for their families. In the end, it's the responsibility of parents to decide what games are appropriate for their families. And again, thank you for allowing me the opportunity to testify, and we urge you to reject House File 1208.
I'm going to take order permit one question, and then we want to go right back to the other testifier because I think they may complement each other's testimony. So, Representative Murphy, you did have your hand up.
And I have the other question, Ms. Celia, also. The same question, Ms. Celia. Ms. Jefferson, were any of the games that were depicted in the short film that we saw, or whatever it was, produced by members of your organization?
Yes, they were.
How many?
I counted probably four. There were some I did not recognize that I haven't seen before. I don't think they're very popular, but anyway. But again,
they were just so very bad.
Well, and it, absolutely. But I would say, certainly, you know, those games are rated M because they are for, you know, people 17 years and older. They are not for younger audiences. And again, while some of that content that we saw may offend most everyone's sensibilities, and I may not care for it either, again, it is a small portion of the content that's out there and that are provided out there and sold for video games.
Good evening, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Marie Silla, and I represent the Interactive Entertainment Merchants Association. The IMA, as we're known, we represent the leading retailers of video games in the U.S. Some of our members are actually constituents of your Target Musicland here in Minnesota. This is where they're headquartered. First of all, I'd like to say that this is a very serious issue, and I'd like to thank you all for letting me and my colleagues come here and talk about this today. IMA, we respectfully oppose House File 1298 because we feel that it is unnecessary because retailers are voluntarily committed to enforcing the ESRB rating system. Additionally, we oppose the legislation because it violates the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. This past December, all IMA members implemented a carding program to card for mature rated games in the stores. Therefore, when a minor under the age of 17 comes to the video game registry, the sales clerk is prompted to ask that minor for some sort of identification to prove that they are over the age of 17 years. And also, I'd like to additionally stress that this is a voluntary rating system, just as movie theater has a voluntary rating system. This past November, the watchdog group, the National Institute on Media and the Families, actually, that was their videotape, released a report. And this report is the annual video game report card.
According to the report Secret Shopper Survey, minors were unsuccessful 66% of the time, while in last year's report, minors were unsuccessful 45% of the time. And we believe that, that's a significant improvement. That shows a 20% drop in the purchase of mature-rated games by minors. And actually, this report was done before December 2004, before all of our retailers actually had their carding program fully implemented. In addition to implementing a carding program, our members have partnered with the ESRB to promote the rating system by promoting, by displaying signage in the stores to educate consumers and sales clerks on the rating system. We believe that this is important because industry studies show that over 90% of the game purchases are done by adults. Therefore, it's important to make sure that parents are educated on the rating system. And today I brought with me a few examples that I'm going to just pass around. And what this is a shelf strip that the ESRB has, and it's okay to play here. And this is the ESRB's okay to play campaign, which all of our members have signed on to. And I'll just pass this around. The next one is actually a shelf strip that you'll see in the video game, all these you'll see in the video game section. And this just says we support the ESRB rating system and not to sell mature rated games to anyone under the age of 17. Moreover, our retailers have taken additional steps by using other channels to promote the video game rating system, by having in-store loops on the rating system, interactive displays, loop tapes, promotions, and PSAs, and postings on their website on the rating system. Also, I'd like to mention that the Video Software Dealers Association, who represents the retailers of video games, they actually have a pledge to parents in which in order for a minor to come and rent a mature-rated game, they actually have to have written permission by the parent on their video game, on their video membership, for them to even take that game out of the store. In addition, we also believe, well, the courts have shown that this type of legislation is unconstitutional. It is clear that in order for state restrictions on video and computer games to be permissible, the material must be legally obscene or obscene for minors, or the restriction must be based on a compelling state interest and narrowly tailored to alleviate the asserted problem. And in a couple of jurisdictions, the one that actually has precedence binding on this was the Eighth Circuit Court decision, IDSA versus St. Louis County, in which the court there struck down a law in which it was a misdemeanor to knowingly sell or rent a minor to a person under the age of 17. So I just wanted to bring that up. In conclusion, it's our belief that tangible and impressive progress is being made through voluntary cooperation through the IMA and the ESRB with regarding to stemming the sale of violent video games to minors. In working with parallel trade organizations and agencies of the federal government, efforts have been undertaken to make further improvements and investments toward that end. And additionally, I just want to emphasize that it is so important for parents to be educated on the rating system, which is why IMA has actually signed on to an initiative that we're going to be doing for the month of June, and it's Entertainment Ratings and Labeling Awareness Month. And I can pass this around as well. But we're going to be promoting not just the video game rating system, but we've joined the movie theater owners, the NARM, the music merchandisers, to actually promote the rating system in the month of June, because that's when kids are out of school. But thank you so much, and if you have any questions, feel free to ask. Thank you. Stella, I'm sorry. Talking.
That's okay. I should have been listening closer. I apologize. You used the phrase declare legally obscene. Has there been any, and I haven't had an opportunity to read this yet, but has there been any video game ever in the country declared legally obscene?
No, not to my knowledge.
Okay. Representative,
Mr. Chairman, really, did any of the games that were portrayed on that film that we saw, are they sold in your stores from the Interactive Entertainment Merchants Association?
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Murphy, some of the games that were on the tape are sold in some of our member stores. Some carry them and some do not. But I really just want to emphasize that they're mature-rated games. And these games, if a minor were to come up to the cash register, the sales clerk is ordered. It's store policy for them to check their ID.
What happens if the sales clerk doesn't, or if the sales clerk sells it to someone that has a false ID for buying video games?
Ms. Silla.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
I thought that was a question.
Okay.
It was a question.
If
I was recognizing Ms. Silla.
Thank you. If the sales clerk does sell the game, well, then they're actions would be taken for violating a store policy, which could be anywhere from probation to termination of employment. My members take it very serious. It's an issue that we discuss with my members, and it's an issue of great concern, and that's one of the reasons why my members decided to adopt a carding policy in stores. Some of them had carding policies already in place. Some did not, and it was a little more than half of them that did not have a policy. Those who had a policy have decided to kind of relaunch those efforts. But there, it's a very important issue. In addition to the policy, they're training the sales clerks on the rating system. We actually have an employee-based incentive program with Microsoft in which our employees can take a quiz online on the ESRB rating system, and also has the enforcement policy in that quiz. And they can earn points, and they can use that towards getting a reward. Over 30,000 employees have actually taken that quiz, but they take this matter very serious.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Cilia, if this law passes, or if this passes into law, then will part of your training program be for your employees be that then they should also pick up the phone and call the police to come and give a petty misdemeanor fine to this 16 or 17 or 7-year-old?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, I'm not sure how it would be implemented because this is, I'm not sure to answer that question how that would be implemented. I guess if the bill was enacted, I'm not sure how retailers would be expected to handle that. So, yeah.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Cilia, I suggest that you start thinking about it.
Okay.
Because,
Yes.
Representative.
Okay. May I just say something in response?
Representative Johnson, go ahead.
There were 9 videos on video games out here, and I did go out to find them. And all but one were either a Blockbuster or a Target. And most of you retailers are right. They are enforcing this already, and they should be getting credit for that. There are some places, obviously, that are not. And this probably gets to them a little bit. This is an important place. One thing that Ms. Jefferson said was it's the responsibility of parents to decide what video games are appropriate for their kids. I couldn't agree more.
All but one of those was purchased at Target?
Could have been purchased at Target or rented at Blockbuster. And one
could not?
I can't remember. I'd have to look back at it again. One of them was in the bargain.
Barris. Representative.
Could have been, or that means at some Target they do sell.
In what?
Oh.
In the city. Representative Ellison.
Can you check out the Duluth one, please?
Mr. Jefferson, Ms. Cilia, what about Representative Johnson's point, though? I mean, no, I did take a minute to look over the Surgeon General's report on violence in 2001, and my reading is that they concluded that this evidence did have a desensitizing impact on kids' violence. And what about the idea, what about this idea that some of the most violent and egregious incidents of school violence we've seen seem to correlate with kids being involved with these violent video games? Do you have any response to that?
Again, as I've noted, the research that's been out there and those experts, the FBI, Secret Service, Surgeon General, that have looked at this issue have found that there is not a causal connection between violent media and violent behavior. And, you know, I have to defer to them and the studies that have been done out there that have looked at this issue.
Any further questions? Any further testimony from anyone in the room? And this is back and forth for discussion and a vote on the motion.
Mr. Chair. Yes, Mr. Chair, I was in another committee and I did not hear what the motion was. So if you could please repeat the motion.
The motion was, Representative Johnson, repeat.
It was to place the bill on the general register without recommendation.
Vote the bill out without recommendation. Representative
Mr. Chair, I had an amendment prepared. I don't know if it got around to everybody. I'd like to move the amendment now.
All right, explain the Representative Ellison moves the Bill 5-0454 amendment. Tell us about the amendment, and then we'll go to Representative Johnson for his reaction. Representative Ellison.
It's just, this is a bill that says what's good for the goose is good for the gander. If it's wrong for kids to buy it, it's bad for people for retail establishments to sell it. And quite simply, the owner of a retail establishment who rents or sells a restricted video game to a person under the age of 17 and an employer responsible for a rental or sale of the restricted video game to a person under 17 is, you know, going to have to pay $25 too. And so that's my amendment, and I urge you to support it.
Representative Johnson, I'd like to hear from all the ladies. This particular language has not been in court. Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I thank you for your amendment. I would prefer that it not go on for a couple of reasons. Reason number one is, again, the point of this is to hopefully raise awareness. And I think what my bill does is, of course, is that raising awareness. This would be an extra step and certainly an extra incentive for those stores who aren't doing it on their parents and anything else. And the other is to be perfectly honest with you, it's for political reasons. It's going to make it hard to pass the bill, and I do want to see something happen.
If I may respond, Mr. Chair, you know, I just think that, you know, this balance is fair. It's just fair, you know, and I think that the retailers, if they're not selling, if their rating system is so good, they wouldn't be worried. They shouldn't be worried about it. I did hear Ms. Celia say that 34% of the kids who try to buy these videos are successful. Maybe I was misheard what you said, but I heard you say 66% are unsuccessful. So on the other side of the coin, I'm assuming about 34% of the kids are successful. That's about, is that a fair statement? Or Mike, did I get that right?
I think you got that part.
Okay. Yeah, I was, you know, lawyers don't know any math, so you got to forgive me on that. But I think about a third of the kids who try to get this stuff get it. So, and I think that if the rating system is good, and I'm sure that it is, that it shouldn't be a problem for anybody. It is only $25. So I would urge support.
Further discussion on the amendment. I did ask a question about whether you could tell us if any of the cases you referenced are included in the packet deal specifically with this language, and if so, what's the result?
Mr. Chairman, there is a binding, the Eighth Circuit ruling, IDSA versus St. Louis, in which there was a county ordinance that said that a retailer could not knowingly sell or rent to a minor under the age of 17 a video game that is harmful to minors. And this was actually struck down by the court who held that the video games are protected speech, depictions of violence are not obscene, and the assertion that violent video games are connected to mental health of minors was simply unsupported in the record. And aiding parental authority is not a compelling government interest that could justify the county's restrictions on violent video games. So the Eighth Circuit did strike down that that law, which found unconstitutional.
Representative Ellison.
Miss Lee, what specific video games were they considering at the time? I mean, I think that there's a fair argument to be made that some of your material on here could be considered in the community standards in Minneapolis, Minnesota, or our state, to be obscene. Obscene is sensitive to community standards, and so I'm not sure that your Eighth Circuit case necessarily saves you here. And let me just be clear. I don't like the bill, and I plan on voting against it, but I figure if we're going to do this, let's be fair to everybody.
Well, the minor, the ordinance described harmful to minors. They said that the video games that meet the legal standard, it was said to be obscene, what they considered obscene was graphic violence or strong sexual content.
Take 2 minutes and testify. We're going to wrap this bill up in 5 minutes with discussion and our vote.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Buzz Anderson. I represent the Minnesota Retailers Association, and we've been involved in this issue for several years. And there's been some reticence on our part to ever support a bill like this, in part because of the not the constitutional questions, although they have clearly been defined by the Seventh and Eighth Circuit, and also the Washington Federal District Court, I understand. Well, our objection has always focused on, number one, if you're going to punish the store, are you going to punish the clerk, are you going to punish the manager, are you going to punish the owner? Who are you going to punish? This is very difficult, particularly when you have hundreds of employees in stores. Keep in mind as well that we also look at this, and I look at this personally, as being the responsibility of the parents. I have 3 children. They do not bring these kinds of videos into our home. We have even MTV blocks on cable at our house, and at Blockbuster, my kids are not allowed to rent any videos that are A-rated, O-rated, AO-rated, mature-rated, or X-rated. It's not permissible. I mean, that we think is the role of the parent. And I guess that's all I can say. Senator Pappas in the Senate has been very good to take this point to heart, and as her bill reflected, as this one does not put a penalty on the retailer, but rather on the person trying to rent. And all I would say, Mr. Chair, I would appreciate it if you would reject this amendment.
Mr. Chair, may I say
the amendment, Representative Ellison.
Folks, we have a cigarette amendment that does punish both sides. Cigarette bill. If you sell cigarettes to a minor, the retailer, the seller is going to have to be responsible. And so what I'm proposing is consistent with other aspects of comparable Minnesota law.
Further discussion. On the amendment, 4-5-4 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
No.
Motion prevails. Then on the bill is amended.
Can I just wrap up with one thing?
Please.
On the constitutional issue, which is a fair issue to bring up, I just want to, if I could read 2 sentences to you from the most recent case that was included in our packet, the Washington case. It says that for all the foregoing reasons, the Act, which is the subject of that lawsuit, does not satisfy the rigorous standards that apply in government's attempts to regulate its expression. Given the nationwide ongoing dispute in this area, it's reasonable to ask whether a state may ever impose a ban on the dissemination of video games to children under 18. The answer is, quote, probably yes, unquote, if the games contain sexually explicit images, and it's cited to the Supreme Court case and one of the other cases here, and, quote, maybe, end quote, if the games contain violent images, such as torture or violence, to appeal to the prurient interests of minors in a citation of the case. It is still an open issue.
Any further discussion on House File 1298 as amended? Senator Soderstrom.
How are we going to test this without recommendation? I think I would like to change that to with recommendation.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Johnson.
Representative Soderstrom, you can, but I would appreciate it if you didn't, because I'm not certain I have the votes if we do that.
We don't.
Okay, there being no further discussion, we are still on the motion as stated by Representative Johnson earlier on the 1298. The bill be moved without recommendation. General Register. Discussion. Any further discussion? If not, those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
Here's in doubt. Let's see hands. Those in favor.
Mr. Chair, give me a...
We're in the middle of a vote. On the other hand, we can suspend as long as I've got the gavel. We need to make a request.
I thought maybe we should discuss a little more. Go ahead, Mr. Chair.
Who are
we missing?
I don't know.
You're allowed to suspend
it. I'm allowed to, I'm just informed, I'm allowed to suspend the vote. Do you want to further discuss? Otherwise, I'll proceed. All right. In favor of the motion, please raise your hand.
1, 2, 3.
Opposed, please raise your hand. Moving 5-3, the motion prevails. Any further? If not, this meeting is adjourned.